meeting of the House Interim Committee on Education will come to order this Thursday, December 16th, 2005. The first item of business before we move to some comments is the adoption of the committee rules. You'll find them under members under your tab marked committee rules. And if you would like to, the one pager, take a quick scan if you have not already. And we will need to move adoption of those for our proceedings as we move through this interim.
Madam Chair, I'm with the. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Pardon me. I see no difference in this set of rules than the rules we operated under before.
Well, had a student an observation that might be, Mr. Vice Chair, that we, this is a new committee and it is the interim, so we adopt new rules.
I'm going to stand down so that the motion can be made.
Thank you, Representative Avakian.
So moved.
Yes, I'd just like to point out item number 10 on our rules. It'll be really important that we have our quorum here for our last meeting, so if we do have any pre-session files, we'll be able to pass those out of committee.
And that last meeting where we would be discussing pre-session files will likely be October, so we want to clear your deck. But we'll get those dates out to you in the very near future as far as a tentative time frame. So Representative Avakian has moved the adoption of the rules as written. Any further discussion other than the point of information? If no discussion, are there any objections to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the motion passes and the committee's rules are adopted. I next would like to each of the members to introduce him or herself, who seem to be the minority here, Representative Kahn. And if you wish, you'd say a little about what you'd like to see accomplished by the House Interim Committee on Education. But first, since we are gathered with guests, I would like to remind you that I'm going to invoke one of the session rules, and that is, with the exception of Representative Comp and Tushy Lane's how to turn off her phone, all guests and members, please check your cell phones to see that they are off so that we would not have that interruption. We can take a vote as to whether we wish to fine for said intrusion. However, it just makes it a little less disruptive.
I think the public humiliation is very effective. Probably suffices.
Okay, public humiliation works all the time. Yeah. Okay, very well. So why do we not start down here on our right and then get to say good morning, Representative Escobar?
Representative Escobar, District 6, Medford, Oregon.
And a little about what you would like to see this committee accomplish, perhaps.
Well, there's a bunch.
Okay.
In fact, we don't have enough time in the interim to do what we need to do. I think I have some concerns about funding, revenue streams. I have some concerns about what we need to look into, how these kids are turning out in school. And the reason I say that, because I had a personal professional experience, and 80% of the kids that were high school graduates were unable to fill out a job application correctly. 80%. Either one, you couldn't read it. Two, there was misspelled words, grammar errors, and or they didn't follow directions. That's concerning to me. I'd like to make sure that our kids have a good, rounded education. And more importantly, we need to look into how, one, is our revenue stream, two, is how we're spending according to our districts. I have yet to have anyone tell me why we have 199 superintendents in the state of Oregon, or can justify it. We have 10 in Jackson County. You can drive across Jackson County in about an hour and 15 minutes on a bad day. 10. Well, $100,000 a year, even though I went to Medford High, I can see that's $1 million. That doesn't include hidden costs. So there's a lot of concerns I have about the education process and the way we're getting the bang for our buck. The other thing is I still haven't figured out is the formula. Maybe I can learn for this formula, because I don't understand why we have so many poor kids and English is a second language that we only get $50-some-hundred a year per student. I don't understand it. But maybe learn that, hopefully. Hopefully I'm going to learn as much from you as you talk about these things that I have concerns with, and then that way I can be more educated on what we do in the process of education itself. It's a big thing that needs to be approached, but the way you do big things is you work on little pieces at a time, and pretty soon it all falls into place.
Thank you, Representative Escobar, and I will point you to the interim work plan, which if you've had an opportunity to look, we will be addressing some of those questions and concerns that you've just noted. Representative
Bakken. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bradavakian from Northeast Washington County. I agree with Representative Escobar that more money per student in public schools would be a good place to start. The this committee, of course, is a... I thought I heard a little bit of that, but you don't mind if I take a few liberties. This, of course, is a policy committee. We'll deal with a number of topics. I'm one that just happens to believe that even given the crises that we have in schools today, I think we have absolutely excellent public schools in Oregon, some of the best in the nation. And what we need to do is we just need to hone our mission. What I would love to see from this committee, from the other related education committees, and from the executive branch is a coordinated effort, all heading in the same direction with regard to pre-K through 16 schools. And in addition to that, there are so many different advocacy groups out there today, all with different messages, with different goals and reforms. And I think we need to be the leaders in this regard and bring them along with us. So a coordinated effort with good communication between the branches of government and our committees is what I most hope to see.
Thank you, excellent. And I think sidebar to that, you probably also said, and I would have to agree with you, that it should not be politicized. So thank you for making the point. Did you make that point?
I think it's a good point for anybody to make. I'll join in.
Representative Wilson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Good morning. This is I'm Representative Gene Wisnett from District 53, which is rural Deschutes County. I have three school districts represented in my district, and it's one of the fastest growing counties in the state and in the West for students and population. This is my second term on the Interim Committee for Education. I'd like to thank a lot of the members in the audience for helping me learn about our education system. There's a lot to learn about it. Also, during the last session, I served on Joint Ways and Means Committee for Education before we split up. I am a numbers person. I think Mr. Jefferson talked about he wanted a government that was a wise government and a frugal government. And one of the things I've added to that, my wish, especially for education, is that our system is transparent. In two interim sessions and one session, it's very complicated and not transparent to me, all the money and where it goes and all that. So that's what I'm trying to learn, so I can express that to the constituents and ask for their support for education, because I support education. And I look forward to working with you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. We will move to Representative Roland.
Mm-hmm. Representative Roland from House District 9, which is down on the Southern Oregon coast. I'm really excited about being here. It was great to be on the Education Committee during the session, and the things that have been mentioned...
You had a really good chair.
I had a great chair. Yeah, great chair.
The inside chair.
For me, it's figuring out how to get a common vision and goal throughout our state back to education again, because I think until we get there, until we're all speaking the same language and we all understand it, it's going to be difficult for our people in our communities, including their families, to help their kids get through school, which we all know is important. It's going to be hard for the teachers to understand what the expectations are, what they're expected to do, and it's hard for the school boards to know exactly where they should be putting their emphasis. And I think that we can help with that. The board needs to be helping with that. The governor's office, or whatever Brad was saying, is really important. And I agree, clearly with the non-politicizing of it. If we can get a solution that helps all students in Oregon, whether they be pre-K through college, progressing, then we will have done our job. And I look at the agenda on the work plan, a lot of those things are issues that need to be addressed. I think what Representative Escobar said about how many school districts there are and all those things, we do need to look at any and all efficiencies we can, but until we really all agree on a vision about what we expect our kids to be able to do and perform, it's difficult for us to recognize that that's what it is, and it's not about political units. It's about helping every student in Oregon achieve. So that's kind of what I hope to be able to do.
Wonderful.
So thanks.
Thank you so much. And Representative Coons.
Well, I'm Representative Betty Kopp, and I'm from House District 22. That's Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and North Salem, a good chunk of North Salem. And I have a disclaimer besides my cell phone, Chairman Flores. You know, we have three educators sitting on this side of the dais. And I already let James know sometimes the reason why we made good administrators because we were the trouble kids in class. And so you might have to,
repeat you if that's what you're saying.
Well, you might just have to say, well, I really knew. Representative Dolan is sharing shock on his face that he was a troublemaker.
No, I knew you and I were. I didn't know Arnie was.
But my pleasure of being here is just, I am very appreciative. And the thing that I am going to advocate for the most, and that is accountability and transparency, because our local residents in our districts and communities don't seem to think that they have a voice, and because they say that they don't have enough information to make good decisions at the local level. And in order for them to do their job to the best capacity to serve our students there, we need to have that accountability and transparency here. And that is in many of the areas that are listed here in our worksheet. So it's a theme that, you know, we need to make whatever we legislate understandable and doable.
Thank you very much. Representative Dolan.
Thank you, Chair Flores. In 1993, I moved to Oregon to be an administrator. At that time, we were in the throes of a huge reformation in education, started by a nation at risk. I think it was, its seeds were coming even before that. But as I looked around, it appeared as though Oregon had the best answer. I still believe that Oregon has the best answer. I wanted high standards. I think we have them. I wanted an assessment system that told us where we were. I think we're moving there. I believed from 600 miles away that we had the partnership. I'm not sure that our partners really are cohesive as they could be. I wanted to come to a state where policy was set at the state level and process was implemented at the local level. And I'm not sure we're there yet. I want the promise of the Oregon Education Act to be fulfilled. I think it's time for us to step back, take a look at where we are, where do we want to be, build the cohesiveness that's necessary to make that happen, and off we go again. I think we can do it. I'm excited to be part of it. The first session was a tremendous educational learning experience about how the system works at the state level. I now have a little bit of insight, and I hope to make a lot of friends and a lot of noise so that our kids are the best educated workforce in the world, and I'm shooting no lower than that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sure you'll make a lot of friends, but I'm sure you'll make some enemies, too. So that goes with the count. Before I give you a few comments from myself, I'll ask our Community Administrator, Jim Keller, to introduce himself and our other assistant, Mr. Golden.
Jim Keller, Community Assistant. I've been in education since the 2003 session, and I'm certainly happy to be back, having some of the same faces back from the session and from the last interim. It's going to be wonderful. James? I can't remember your background. You want to give us a little bit, please?
Well, I've served in the process since 2001. It's a brief for the Senate for 2 sessions.
Thank you very much, and it's wonderful to have you both with us. Well, I'm Linda Flores. I am obviously chair of the Interim Committee on Education and served as chair during the last session and had been vice chair of the prior interim as well. I serve House District 51, which is primarily Clackamas, Damascus, Bowling, Estacada area, and a little bit of Southeast Portland, Multnomah County. I think that my goals are pretty reflective in the interim work plan that I think is available to our guests and is in our notebook. But I'm coming at policy that we deal with in not only in this committee but in this legislative body, I think with a renewed, very succinct threefold approach. Number one, we can't solve a problem until we acknowledge there is a problem, and I think that especially those in the legislative situation and in the public bodies of education acknowledge there's a problem. There's probably some pushback that everybody in the state, every parent acknowledges there's a problem, but they hear there's a problem. So we can't solve it until we all acknowledge there's a problem. Number two, we can't solve a problem by continuing to do the same things that we've always done. And number three, we can't solve a problem if we do nothing. So I'm hopeful that we'll not lodge in that number three category. I'm hopeful that we can work together for some very good solutions to some of the problems that not only are perceived, but in fact indeed are real. And lastly, I am very concerned that we approach what we do here, as well as in our other legislative responsibilities, and trying to strip away anything that would politicize those things that we are charged to do, and take the politics out and do the things that people sent us here to do. So those are my hopes and my goals, and with that, we will just take an overview of the notebook. Jim, would you like to walk us through that?
Certainly. We have a tab for everyone, the 2005 legislative history. That is every House bill and Senate bill that was dealt with during the last session. So you can make reference back to that. The upcoming discussion we're going to have with the Oregon State School Board is the next item, and then information regarding our conversation on the 1M at ESD this afternoon is the last item. The choices will be each of yours. If you would like us to maintain your notebooks, just sit in here and we'll take care of it. If you want to take them with you, that's great. As we get more information to put in the notebook, I can just send that out to you, whatever your pleasure. If there's something that you need that I haven't put in here already, please let me know and we'll get it to you as soon as we can.
Question, Representative.
Comment, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'd like to thank you and Mr. Keller for scheduling the meeting later today. I wasn't sure about my travel plans and getting back. As the only member who does have to cross the mountains during the winter, excuse me, Mr. Vice Chair Dellum. You go down. You come down at 84, don't you?
Blow down 84.
I would appreciate maybe if Mr. Keller could. I'm on the judiciary that could do any back-to-back scheduling for the, especially the winter months. Would be greatly appreciated. Before, or after judiciary, in conjunction with those, I would. And I mentioned that to Patsy and Chair Creed.
We'll accommodate that as best we can. Any of the others or the rest of us that have other committee responsibilities, we'll try to coordinate as best we can. And as you can see, our work plan is pretty aggressive, and we've been kind of streamlined in the numbers of committees meetings that we will have, so we will condense number one the numbers of meetings, but with that we will extend the time frame. So I will expect that we'll meet a full day from 9 to 4 with a lunch break when we do meet.
Madam Chair, another question.
Representative Wilson.
Are there some task force that are looking at other education issues too? Is that true? And are they going to be, are we having some way to share that? Or I thought there was a task force assigned to look at the formula. Is that correct?
The this education committee will meet jointly with the revenue committee to look at the state school fund, the distribution formula, and the school transportation formula. So, yes, that will be a joint meeting that we will have, a joint meeting.
Thank you.
To my understanding. And then there is the Special Legislative Committee on Public Education Appropriation, which will meet, and there are those members have already been assigned. So. Further questions, comments, before we move forward? And I think we shall move right into our agenda for this morning. We'll open an informational hearing on proposed high school graduation requirements. And with us today are members of the Oregon State School Board. And we are delighted to have you here.
Thanks for the honor.
Where'd you get your time?
If when you introduce yourself, if you would, for the record, give us your name, and you can give us your dialogue, and then we'll probably have some back and forth. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Nikki Squire. I'm the chair of the State School Board this year. I live in Bend, so like Representative Whitner, I came across the mountains this morning. I serve in one of the two at-large positions on the board. The board has seven members, one from each congressional district and two at-large, and I'm one of those. On my left is Steve Bogart, who is the former chair. Steve has served since July of 1999. His term ends at the end of June in 07. Steve is from Baker City, and he fills the seat from the 2nd Congressional District. And to Steve's left is Duncan Wise. Duncan has served since July of 2004. His term ends in the end of June in 08. Duncan is from Portland. He fills the seat from the 1st Congressional District on the board. And on my right is our Vice Chair, Jerry Berger. Many of you may know Jerry. He's been on the board since June 30th of 04. His term ends in 08. Jerry's from Salem and is from the 5th Congressional District, fills that slot. I was...
excuse me, Ms. Squire.
Yes.
We're having a little technical difficulty, so if we can have you amp your voice a little bit, that would be helpful.
Okay. I'm not often accused of being too quiet, so... All right. I'll do that. Just a little bit. I think most of you probably know all about the Board of Education and what we do and how we get to be where we are. But in case there is someone who would like a little more about that, we are volunteers. We are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. As I said, seven members. Our primary responsibility is to establish policy for the administration and operation of public elementary and secondary schools and for the community colleges. Each of us may serve up to two consecutive terms of four years each. We also establish the standards and adopt the rules for the general governance of the public kindergartens, elementary, high schools, and community colleges. We hire the commissioner of the community colleges and the workforce development department. And we adopt the standards governing the distribution of state funds to the community colleges, not to the K-12, as you know, and for capital construction projects as well. I believe you have at your place, John, do we have the one page? Okay. At your place, a kind of one page handout. This is a summary of our goals It's a piece that we have used to guide us for several years now. And you will see on that one-page sheet a series of six important guides for us. We are committed to a Common Core of rigorous standards for all. I feel like Representative Dahlin speaking here, as I do, but I think you will see we're very much on the same page with what we heard each of you saying today. We are committed to policies that will provide for a personalized learning experience for each student. We believe that a core of quality educators prepared and ready to take on new challenges is essential to the success of our public schools. We have been working hard on aligning the pre-K-16 system. By that we mean we want it to be easier for students to move from one level to another. And we'll talk more about that today, this connecting of what it is we want students to know and be able to do at the end of each segment of their education, matching more closely what it is they need to know and be able to do as they enter the next. We are devoted to the notion of a connected educational community, partners working together, and we're very grateful to be here with you today. Finally, we have a strong commitment to a system that will provide adequate and appropriately allocated resources, a challenge always, one that we have had less influence on than I think sometimes board members feel we might like to have, and so we're interested in working with you and other key leaders on that issue. As I'm sure you know, the board developed what has been called a white paper or a policy paper over the course of our work last year, and we adopted that paper at our annual retreat this summer, and we have been in the process of distributing that white paper for public comment now over the last several months. We have actually reached over a million people with that paper, and a long list of stakeholders that we have actively presented the paper to and sought comment from. We're very interested today, among other things, to hear from you about some of the proposals in the white paper. Duncan Wise is going to talk with you a little bit about the white paper and that process. And then I think what we would like to do is hear what you want from us, what you would like to ask us, and respond in any way that you think would be appropriate for our cooperative work together.
Thank you, Vicki. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Duncan Wise. I am a member of the State Board of Education and also a member of the Quality Education Commission. I want to give you a little bit of context on what has become known as the white paper, which the board did issue for this fall. It's actually officially titled the Notice of Policy Review and Request for Comments. And I think both of those are really important. The first, the Notice of Policy Review. This document is a result of the board members really taking a look at how the system of standards assessments, the certificates associated with the K-12 system are faring. We all came onto the board. A number of us are relatively new. Steve is our wise, longer-term member. As we came in, I think you'll discover we ask a lot of questions as board members, and we wanted to take stock of how things were going. And we also were listening to your deliberations in the legislators, and we also in the legislature, and we're also out in the field talking with folks. And I think what we all came to realize is that we, over the last 15 years, have put together a very ambitious reform proposal in the form of 3565 that Representative Donald mentioned, and a very bold set of reforms, and they're now 15 years old, and it's time to take stock of how they're working. And what we decided as a board was, first of all, to describe what we've created. It's very important to make sure we all understand what it is we've put together here in Oregon. Second, to give some meanings about how we see the system working, what we see the successes as well as the challenges to be. And then finally, and this is most important, the request for comments, to make it clear to the field, and that means everybody, parents, students, teachers, principals, superintendents, higher education, legislators, policymakers, all of us, that we as a board are really interested in hearing from all of our audience about what's working, what isn't working, and what we ought to do to go forward. And that I can't stress enough, because there's some perception in some few parts of the field that somehow we already know what we're about to do, and we're just, you know, this is just a warm. The reality is, I think all of us can safely say we are eager to listen right now. We're in a process of reviewing, and we want to hear what folks have to say. And so, as Nikki pointed out, we've reached out as widely as we can in this first phase, and we anticipate additional phases. So if we don't receive the comments on the 15th, when the first round are due, there'll be other opportunities for people to be engaged as the year unfolds. Our goal is, by the fall of this year, of 2006, of next year, to have for you and Oregon a set of recommendations for either board adoption, for the state board, for legislative adoption, on what the system of standards, assessments, certificates look like that align the K-12 system firmly with the higher ed system, the community college system, and book. So that we have a system of aligned standards, assessments, and certificates, and we want to try to present to you what the architecture of that would look like. And that's our goal, and that's what this paper is all about. And so we're taking a look at how we're doing and asking for comments on what we need to do next. The paper, if you've had a chance to look at it, is divided, and I'm just going to touch it on briefly, into three sections. The first section really is about what are we trying to accomplish. A number of you talked about the vision. You know, when you start all this work, and as we pointed out, when we look back at 3565, and a number of us in this room have been around long enough to remember the whole history, this was about, as one of you mentioned, it really had emerged in the 80s with the initiative risk report. And this was Oregon's response to a challenge that, again, I think we all recognize. The world we're going into, the civilization of the 21st century, requires higher levels of knowledge and skills to be successful than any period in human history. We need to raise the bar on education to a level, frankly, that has never happened before. We need more Oregonians educated at higher levels so they can do the jobs that are going to be required in the knowledge workforce, so they to participate in civic society and to live rich, rewarding lives. So we need to raise the standards for everyone. That was not how the system was designed in the past. It wasn't designed necessarily to do that, and we need to design a system that sets a high bar for all students to give them an opportunity. That was the vision in 3565. When we talked about the board's perspective on it, we agree with that. I think we all agree that we want to design a system that would meet those needs. And as we reviewed how the system worked, we saw that it actually has had some considerable successes. When we set standards for reading in elementary school, for example, we've seen a significant improvement in reading scores. And I know, I'm sure you all have gone out and looked at schools and talked with teachers, and when you see schools that are high-performing, you see schools that are very focused, for example, on reading benchmarks and how to move students to meet higher standards. And we're seeing remarkable improvement on reading scores. We're seeing remarkable improvement on math scores when schools get focused. And we've seen that especially in elementary years. We've seen it also in middle school to a lesser but important extent. But we also have seen real challenges as we move into the high school years. And the paper highlights some of the challenges we face as we look at the system of standards and the certificates that we have in place for high school. We point out that when you move into high school, you then are starting to connect with higher education, and the connections with all the certificates are frankly very clunky. The SIM, the CAM, this high school diploma, none of those certificates are particularly well connected with the community college system, the higher ed system, and that creates real challenges for students trying to navigate in. And as we try, as Nikki described, to create a more seamless system, there's some really difficult issues as we look at those systems. At the same time in the high school, we also stress that the SIM and the CAM have had remarkable successes. Especially, and again, we talk less about the CAM often, but throughout the report you will see examples where the applied learning, the contextual learning, students learning in the field, if you will, in businesses or in other forums, have really motivated students to levels never before seen. And the schools that have adopted it have had some tremendous success. We've also seen good examples of in all schools of students working to meet standards.
Yeah, sure.
Given that, are you concerned about where the state school superintendent is headed with regard to CIN CAM?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Rockian, as this paper points out, and I'll let my other board members respond if they like as well, what we're saying, and I believe she's saying, is while there is much good work that has happened with the current system of certificates, it's time to look at the whole architecture, and there's some real challenges. And as I've said, we don't want to abandon the car. We may want to create a new model, and I think that's a fair way to think about it. I think we need to build on the good work we have done and think about how all these certificates, the standards, can connect better with the future. Because I think one of the things, if you talk to students, they will tell you that certificates don't connect well with their next steps, and we've got to figure out how to do it. So what I would say personally, and again, I'll let the other board members respond, is the content, the concepts of high standards, applied learning, contextual learning in high school are very, very good concepts. We've got to make sure we're designing the system to enable students to move in that direction, and we need to look at the acronyms and the specific standards, but the basic design is behind 35 system.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to, and other board member, I'm curious what the board's position is. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that the CIM and the CAM are beneficial and should be continued. They just need to be in some way modified, I suppose, but that you see value in maintaining those that element of public education. Am I hearing you right?
Madam Chair, Representative Valencian, I believe that we're very interested in maintaining the standard. The nomenclature, if you will, the titles of CIM and CAM, we've actually made a conscious effort to avoid, even though it's a legislated artifact, if you will. So what we're trying to do is to make it as relevant, make the learning and the standards as relevant to students and what they hope to accomplish as we possibly can. We have not integrated it enough into the graduation or, I guess, student accomplishment regimen as we would like. So, in fact, the name is there, but we certainly don't want to compromise the standards.
Madam Chair, I don't talk to administrators much, but I do talk to a lot of teachers. There's a substantial amount of frustration on the teacher level of all the hoops that we jump through with testing. Now, that kind of threw me at first. I thought, what do you mean? Well, they said, well, we have state, we have federal, but more importantly, now we're adding with local. And a lot of our time is spent around these tests. And we don't get to teach like we should be teaching. We're teaching testing. Now, have you thought of an approach on that? Because if you're doing a federal testing, if you're doing a state testing, and then the district throws in their own testing, we're testing and testing and testing.
Well, one of the major pieces of the policy paper raises that whole arena.
Good.
Madam Chair, Representative Escobar.
Yeah, I should have highlighted this at the beginning. The three pieces of the policy paper, really, one is, I've just been talking about, is the big vision of where are we going, what are we trying to drive the system. The second is the system certificates that we go into more deeply, and the third is success competencies. And we're inviting comments on each of those areas. And again, I hear your question, Governor Rockin, but the other thing I would stress is, this is why we're listening. I mean, again, I have some ideas. I think the board leaning suggests we are interested in high standards. We are interested in the value of applied learning. And we're very interested in connecting all that to the next stages. And again, I would stress very much that the current system does not connect well with either community college or higher ed. And that's important, and we've stressed that in the paper. But those are leanings, and we're here to listen to get the perspective of this committee and of educators so that we can really design a system that works for kids. That's what we're all about.
Can I add one more perspective when we're done?
I think that what I would like to do, Representative, is have each of the members give us their points that they would like to present, and then we'll start engaging in dialogue and addressing questions. So if you have questions as we move forward, please make note of those so that we can come back and then dialogue a little bit.
Okay, so again, that's the first section. I'll try to go over this quickly because I hope if you've had a chance to look at it, or you will, and we can certainly talk about it. But I just wanted to give a flavor of what the paper is covering. The second question, so with that as an overview, again, I think we're committed to high standards to help connect with higher ed and advanced learning. The second section really deals with the question of the credentials, the high school credentials. And we spend a fair amount of time describing what we have in place. And frankly, it's fairly complicated because this system, which we've created, has been built over decades. And as we describe it here, we really have two systems of credentials that are in place, in especially as it comes to high school. It was really throughout, but especially in high school. The one is what you and I probably all remember. It's a seat time-based system. It's a credit-based system. You go to school, you take classes, you get grades, you graduate. And that was the system we had up until 35-65, and I think we all need to recognize and remember there were some serious challenges with that system, which is why we created a new one. The challenges were that students were not graduating from high school meeting standards necessary to move on to higher education and to work, that lots of students got lost in that system, and that the standards often were not high enough for a lot of students to ensure that they had the skills and knowledge to move into jobs. So we created a second system. This is not unique in Oregon, although we moved into it quicker than most places, a system not built on credits and seat time, but on proficiencies. And the idea of the system is to demonstrate knowledge and skills in a consistent way so that we can document learning throughout the high school years and into college. And that was what became known as the proficiency-based model. So you have assessments, you have tests, which students need to pass to move to earn the certificates of initial and then advanced mastery. And those became, of course, built into the entire education system, starting with the third grade benchmark, the fifth grade benchmark, the eighth grade benchmark, the SIM, and the CAM. And the proficiency-based system is a revolution. There's no question about it. It's a different system for education. And we put that with the, we built that into our education system and, frankly, created two different kinds of credentials, the high school diploma and the certificates of initial or advanced mastery. One piece of work that is not well recognized that the board accomplished and is starting to be implemented is proficiency-based credit. Many states have proficiency-based systems. Nearly every state has a credit-based system. I think we're one of the very few states that has adopted a policy that if schools choose to, they can offer credit when students demonstrate proficiency associated with a particular class. And it's a way of blending these two systems. So if I take a math class, it could be in a different form than you'd see in a traditional seat-based school, you can get credit for it. And that allows internet-based learning. It allows applied learning. You might learn your math in context of a project, an engineering project. If you can demonstrate you've learned it, you can get credit for it under the Oregon-based system. And it allows more flexibility for high schools to design curriculum in ways that work for kids and demonstrate proficiency and then receiving the credit. So we've got all those these pieces in place in terms of our system. But again, as I described earlier, none of those systems particularly connect well with the next stage partners, the community college, higher ed, or employers. And so while we've got this in place, the connections are not particularly strong. And as we looked at this, we think it's very important that a student moving through high school know that the test they're taking not only is relevant perhaps for No Child Left Behind, but is also relevant for their college plans or their community college plans or their work plans. So we need to find a way that the assessments and the certificates all line up so that the students find meaning. So as we looked at the certificates and the credentials, we see the need for creating something that motivate students to want to achieve them. And one proposal we had was to try to build a new, if you will, higher standard high school diploma that might include proficiency-based requirements in it. Now, obviously, if we go that direction, we've got to decide what we include in it. But not only you, of course, adopted legislation to require more math and English, but we also could include it in high school diploma requirements for proficiency-based learning, potentially, to add value, to create meaning and value into the high school diploma. It's a proposal we put out in the paper, what we want to hear about. We're not sure it's the right proposal, but we want to at least engage in that dialogue. What we've said in the paper is we're open to suggestions, and the questions we've asked is what should be included in the high school diploma requirements, and what can we do to improve the credentials, including the diploma, the honors diploma, SIN, CAM, GED, and others. So that's the credentialing, and that moves us very quickly to the third topic, which is the system of standards and assessments, which, again, we start by describing what we have in place. The State Board has adopted, under your direction, a system of standards for the major academic areas and for the certificates of advanced mastery, and we have put in place an assessment system, a three-part assessment system, multiple choice, state performance assessments, and classroom work samples, which will enable students to demonstrate their knowledge of the standards that have been set by the board. And we describe all of that. And then we talk about what we see the value of an assessment system to be towards the end of the paper. And we have a number of criteria we set out for the assessment system that we think Oregon needs. And we ask the parties to give us their advice on whether the current assessment system meets those criteria and what suggestions they have to make the assessment system better. I know this is an area you've been interested in. We've promised and we are going to do a complete review of the assessment system. I would just say it's a complicated topic. I may let Nikki, who's been more involved on the ground with this, comment on it. But we're very open to looking at an assessment system that meets these various criteria, that helps students and teachers above all measure student progress, that supports teachers, that measures the success of individual schools for accountability, that connects with higher ed successfully, and it really helps build a seamless system, and we think that's really important. And we'll be spending a lot of time this year looking at different assessment regimes and what they would do. I would point out in all this that the department has been terrific in helping support this work. They're giving us their suggestions. They've been really strong in getting the word out about this. We couldn't do it without very, very capable staff. And again, as one board member, I would just say I think we have a terrific board right now listening hard. We're working well together. We have very diverse points of view, but I think I'm really hopeful that we'll be able to bring a product back to you that you can be proud of. So I will stop there, and I think it's best now for the fellow board members to give their reflection on this. Okay, question.
For the record, I'm Jerry Berger, Representative Flores, member of the committee. What the white paper does, first of all, most of the seven board members were new. So what you do have in the white paper is we tried to explain what is and what it meant. Which, when I came out, my background was community colleges. I thought I knew something about K-12, but I had a huge knowledge gap regarding what did it mean. So the white paper captures what is, which is helpful. Is helpful to me because I had my ideas of the SIM, I had my ideas of CAM, and I tell you, they weren't what SIM and CAM were. And I think that's one of the challenges that's faced in Oregon, is everybody has their viewpoint of what the SIM is and what the CAM is. If nothing else, hopefully the paper spells out what that is. For your information, the SIM has never been required to meet for high school graduation. Some districts have adopted it. Many districts have not. So if you hear input, I don't like the SIM, da-da-da-da-da, it isn't required for high school graduation. That's something that a lot of people don't know. We talk about transitions in education. And one of the big questions of the paper is, what do we want from a high school graduate? But think what happens to high school graduates. If you want to go to Stanford, that's your goal. Do we want to set that as a standard for high school graduation? Today, we're going to have a lot of people
not getting the high school graduation. And I think that's the push. What's, and I hate to use the term, minimum, because we don't like to think minimums, but eventually we have to decide what it is we want for a student to be certified as a high school graduate. And no matter what we adopt, it won't necessarily mean that if they don't want to go to Stanford, there are no guarantees that you're going to go to Stanford, so that high school graduation requirement might not meet that. And that some people can criticize that then because it didn't meet my child's needs. But what we're really struggling with is, what do we say we want? And then the big question is, do we really want to live with it? It's easy in abstract to say I want every student to achieve these things. But we've got some school administrators here. When my child doesn't achieve that, and you tell my child you can't graduate, there's some pushback on that. And there's pushback on the superintendents, principals, and real pushback on the teachers regarding what that is. So in our best intentioned, as a state, what we demand will have impact regarding who graduates, who doesn't graduate, etc. I make one comment, my board gets tired of hearing it. I'm a our society, there are 16-year-olds, there are 17-year-olds. I've had one in my family that really didn't want to learn when they were 16 and 17. So the statistics, sometimes schools get the benefit, or the disbenefit, that's not a word, of our people's behavior. And then schools are judged by that. Well, if a 16, 17-year-old doesn't want to finish those competencies, doesn't want to finish those classes, they don't finish it, and therefore the school gets, quote, the blame, and it may really not be the school. But that's hard to talk about because people don't want to look at each individual makes individual choices, they make decisions, and that has impact on where they can go, how they can achieve. And what we are doing as a board is looking at the graduation requirements, and what we're trying to do is define this is what we want to adopt in Oregon, and it will then, or hopefully, will lead to students being able to go towards where they want to go. But there's a big difference of going to Stanford and perhaps going into a minimum wage job. And what's the question between what do we set as that standard? And that's what we're wrestling with.
Madam Chair?
One minute.
Steve,
and then
I had a couple of things.
Representative Esquivel,
Thought you'd spoken.
Thank you.
They're chomping at the bit to get out.
Well, it gave me a chance to realize Representative Flores, Representative Escobar. There are two or three things that the historical perspective that I carry with this and the perspective as an employer that I bring to this. A number of the points that you made earlier during your introductions are particularly relevant. One thing that I want to make sure that you're aware of is we have worked arduously to keep this student-centered, student-focused. You know, we're talking about changing a system to better provide an education to a student, not so a system can function better. It's also geared, and we keep in mind and have lengthy discussions about the next steps, higher education. It points to the fact that there's an expectation on the part of nearly all employers now that there is need for ongoing continuing education, whether it be in your field or just broader education. And that concept has not reached a number of students and a number of employees yet. If you have a job, gosh, I'll be happy doing this job for the next 40 years, that job won't exist probably in 10 or 15 years. So you need to be prepared for those next steps. And I think that's something that we have to keep focused on is student-focused and what those students are going to do with their life. And they will be lifelong learners, and education will be an integral part of their life, but they will be it's our hope and expectation that they will be active, productive members of society, and we need to reinforce that in the learning environment as the students move through the process, especially those students who have not been in an environment, whether they're new to the state, to the country, transitional students who've been in and out of schools. It needs to be a place that they recognize that this is going to benefit them, and that's something that hasn't been in place. I think our system is transitioning, as been mentioned a couple times, and that recognition that the system now needs to catch up with the needs of society and the needs of the students. I guess those are the general points that I wanted to make sure you were aware of.
Thank you, Ms. Squires. Chair Burns, members of the committee, there are just a couple of points that I would add now and then answer your questions. One would be that the question about whether or not to keep or not keep the Simmons camp that's not our decision to make. As you know, that is your decision to make. Those certificates are in legislation. And so our hope is to come forward with recommendations to you based on the best information we can gather and thinking and learning we can do. Ultimately, whether we will continue to have some of them will be decided here. Secondly, however that may go, when we talk about the importance of transparency, we see that not only from the standpoint of how we distribute and spend money, but also the understandability of the system itself. A diploma is a universally understood credential. Whatever else we do, I do believe the board is committed to that being meaningful. It needs to, the diploma, earning the diploma itself needs to convey something of value. Right now, for some students, it conveys extraordinary achievement. For other students, it conveys having received a D average in 22 units and putting the time. And we don't have, as a state, we don't have anything to distinguish one level of accomplishment from another with that diploma. Now, a number of school districts do. The third thing I would say that I think is a major issue in all of this, whether we're talking about assessments, credentials, standards, and it comes right to the heart of the question that you asked earlier, Representative Esquivel, about all these assessments. Different levels of the system have different needs and roles. All of them are valuable. So sorting out what is the appropriate role for the state in those things, what is the appropriate role for the district, what's the appropriate role for the individual teacher and the individual student is what makes some of this so complex. Teachers value assessments that tell them how individual students are doing and inform them about how well their instruction is working for those students. At the state and federal level, there's a value placed on being able to grade, if you will, not students, but schools and school districts. And the kind of assessment that it takes to do those different things is entirely different. One does not serve the other purpose very well. Being able to serve those multiple purposes with the least intrusion into quality instruction is one of the most complex set of decisions that we all face together and one with which we're wrestling. There's so much to say about this. I'm sure you have questions, and we're really here to listen to you and to answer your questions. So,
well, let's start with a lineup. I'll give you the first three, and I know that y'all have questions. So I know Representative Babakian was on in the batter's box. We'll have Representative Esquivel, and then we'll have Representative Dolan, and then you can punch in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, yes. I want to thank all of you and the board as a whole for taking on what is just these days a very difficult task in bringing together these concepts of public education. You've done it aggressively, and you've done it well and comprehensively. And there are some questions I have or some thoughts I have, but those are not meant to, I guess, counter the good work that you've all done.
before I get to city council, one of the things that you just said I think is interesting too. And Mr. Berger, you too, you're right that the city council is it isn't something that has to be done. It's something that's available to students. They don't have to do it. And I would liken that to the federal standards that you just mentioned. Those are not things that have to be done. We don't have to grade our schools. We don't have to do No Child Left Behind. We do if we want to get the money. What I would like to see from the board that I haven't seen is an analysis of what's more important to us, to grab the buck and let the federal government control our destiny with regard to public education policy, or whether or not when you look at the policies that are needed in order to raise a well-rounded and developed child, those federal standards are doing it. And I haven't seen that type of analysis done. My conclusion would be to kick the feds out of Oregon, tell them to keep their money, and have Oregon stand on their own 2 feet with regard to funding and policy both. Because I believe it's a state issue, not a federal issue. But at some point in the future, I'd love to have the board's opinion about those things. With regard to the SINCAN and the standards, it's interesting how Oregon for the last 30 years occasionally goes through these reforms on education, like the system wasn't good to begin with. And I look at SINCAN as one providing information to students and parents and teachers, but the other is it was, especially the CAM, it was supposed to act as a bridge between education and the private sector and employment. And I look back just 20 years, not even that long, 15 years ago in my district in Beaverton, when we didn't have some CAM, but what we had was we had apprenticeship programs at every middle school, not the high schools, but the middle schools. We have apprenticeship programs in plumbing, in electrician. My middle school, going away, I almost sound like Bob Dole talking about the old days. My middle school built a house every year. Brought in professional people from the community, teamed them up with kids beginning in the eighth grade, and they were actually out doing the job. Now, and then when you got to high school, it was even more in depth than that. Now, when I look at that kind of a system, the building of relationships between students, between people in the community and students, between teachers and students, the involvement of families in those types of projects, and I compare it to the taking of the test, the writing of a paper, and doing something for a short, limited period of time like SINCAN is, I don't know why we changed the system. So I would be curious, if any of you want to comment on it, about what it is we gave up prior to the early 90s, the reforms of the early 90s, in comparison to what it is we have now, and why we're not reviewing some of the great things we used to have in Oregon public schools. Is that a clear enough question?
Do you want to go?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm sure Representative Rocky. I mean, I'm a product of Portland schools. I had a great experience, and I look back, you know, fondly of Wilson High School in a lot of ways. But as I reflect, looking back today, and looking deeply at the data, schools were not as good as you think they were, frankly. There were lots of students back then who were not meeting standards, who were going out into the world in a time when you could get a good job with virtually no skills. An example I always give is my job at Crown's Hill back in the summer of college. It took me 2 minutes to learn, and I learned more in that job than I did when I graduated from college in a professional job. There were good, blue-collar, low-skilled jobs, and lots of people left high school with very low skill levels. They did, and the data, we've confirmed it again and again with assessment tools, and employers confirm it. So there is a problem. There was a problem then, and frankly, there still is a problem in terms of the knowledge and skills students have. You're absolutely right that one of the tools to achieve higher standards is exactly the experience you had. Contextual, applied learning, doing something where you learn why you need to know math because it's absolutely essential to build that house is a great tool, and that's really what the CAM was all about. It wasn't about necessarily, it was really about creating a model that would be more universal to help all students have those kinds of experiences. But I don't think we can look back and say that system is great, we just need to go backwards. There are some issues with assessment you've raised. When you start creating assessment systems, you run some risks. But I think what we need to do is take the best of local control and local flexibility and the best of a strong system of standards and assessments that ensure that all students meet high standards. And again, I would stress especially those who traditionally have been disadvantaged, people of color and low-income students who have not been served well. And we need all of us. We need for justice as well as for the future of the economy. We need everybody to meet high standards. And so I think what we've got to do is take what we've learned in the last 15 years, work with it, and take the best of all the work we've been doing over the years to build the model we need for the future.
Madam Chair, members, I might add to that I'm the product of an Oregon, a very rural Oregon public high school, and also had a great experience that enabled me to go into the world and do what I wanted to do. But at the time that I graduated from high school, we did not talk about dropouts. We talked about those of us who intended to finish and go on to school, and those who were going to work in the lumber mill. And many of the people in my class went to work in the lumber mill when they were 16, 17 years old. That wasn't considered anything other than a normal course of life. We sorted and selected people in ways that it simply is not feasible to do anymore if we want all folks to have an opportunity for a good life. I also think that we have a tendency to forget that the very same year that House Bill 2565, the 20th Century Schools Act, SEN-CAM, whatever label you want to put on it, it passed the same year that Measure 5 passed. And a good deal of the losses, and I would agree with you, Representative Ockham, that there have been many in some school districts, in middle school districts, a good deal of the loss was not so much a product of the law as it was a product of the shifting of control along with taxing authority from the local level to the state level. So those school districts that had been doing wonderful things, like Beaverton, where you were, and a number of others we could name, lost their capacity to make the kind of local self-taxing decisions that enabled them to build houses with eighth graders. And I think we sometimes mix and match what the causes have been for some of those changes. I lament mightily, although I know that students' test scores have been improving in the core subjects all the way along, and I think that's wonderful, I lament the loss of the arts. The loss of that much more comprehensive kind of education that we used to deliver in most public school districts in Oregon. Not all of them, but most of them. The other thing we lost was the unevenness, for good or for ill. Where you live in Oregon now is much less likely to affect the quality of your education than it was when you were in school or I was in school. Local control was everything then, and some places that was wonderful, and some places it wasn't so wonderful. So that would be my perspective on the question.
Either of the other members care to comment then?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, No Child Left Behind, one board member, is not working. No Child Left Behind is going under changes. And that'll be interesting to see what changes are. It's because basically schools get tagged. They can be successful one year, not successful the next year. And after a while, you get immune to what does it mean. So there are, actually the federal government is looking at what changes need to take. As board members, we've talked to students. Why should they care about a test for the feds? It has no impact on going to school, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We've heard from students, but they basically just, they don't care. So that's one of the interesting things about questions and testing and comment is that it doesn't count for anything. If you're doing it for the feds, if you're doing it for the state, and it doesn't really have any impact for where the student wants to go, how seriously would you take it? So it's really interesting what does the result we're getting mean anyway. And I just want to, No Child Left Behind has a great concept, which is help each individual student, help them grow, but the testing is a conglomerate test. It's not an individual test. So it's, but the feds realize, I think, that No Child Left Behind, the unintended consequences of No Child Left Behind are interesting in what's occurring.
I would just hasten to add before we move forward,
not to challenge No Child Left Behind, just to add to your comment, Mr. Berger, that we asked you that one of the also goals of No Child Left Behind is to close the achievement gap, and we are seeing significant progress in that area. And also, we are also seeing that those changes that that need to be addressed are coming forward, and I think the WISRM just recently released. So they're listening as well to help improve that whole process so that those achievement gaps and bring children to a higher level.
Chair, I won't ask another question, but could I just clarify one of my comments regarding that? Regardless of whether No Child Left Behind is effective, not effective, good or bad, the issue I was trying to bring up was one of federalism. And whether or not it's the federal government's job to be imposing by holding money in one hand and the standards in another, this on our state. My comment would be that it is not. If there's good stuff in that act, let's adopt it and let's do it as a state, standing on our own 2 feet or flying with our own wings, as it goes, as opposed to having the federal government do it for us. Thank you.
And I think that's a revenue discussion as well. Yeah. And you address that. Representative Westlaw?
Yes, I have a couple things. One is I was on the committee to establish a curriculum for a rural community college down in Jackson County. And the one thing that came out that really surprised me, I mean, at first I thought it was a joke, actually. Someone put in, it was business people, put in, they would like to have employees know responsibility of a job, to be able to show up to work on time, and to balance their checkbook. I was astounded. I thought it was actually a joke, and of course the guy that threw it in there I went to school with, and I asked him about it, and he was dead serious. That's amazing. That's from the business community itself. The other thing that I'm advocating very strongly that we look at as an education system as a whole is skill centers. There's a joke in Southern Oregon, would you rather get a hold of a neurosurgeon or a plumber, and the answer is the neurosurgeon because it costs you less and the availability is better. That's about the truth. You take a plumber and they make excellent money. Or you take an electrician, they make excellent money. Brad's Representative Vacken's correct. We had auto shop, we had different kinds in fact, we even had a program where the kids in high school for a half a day could go out to the retail section and work within the community at certain jobs. And they received credit for that. Why? Because just like Jerry said, not everyone's going to go to Stanford, so you don't set the bar level there. But you do have people that are very, very talented, and it may not be academically for busy work like that. It may be with these two things right here. The most impressive thing I ever saw was 549C when they worked with troubled youth, and they would, Brad talked about building a house. They would renovate housing with the supervision of a contractor, and these kids never came to school until they got in that program. And then their attendance was substantially better. I believe one person went from missing 20-some days in one term to zero. They were using mathematics. You know, they were measuring. They were figuring out. They were using physics. They were using code, which means discipline. And they had no idea what they were doing, what they were learning. But they were learning a lot. And that's why I'm an advocate for skill centers, and I think we should maybe look into that as a whole. The other thing that has been mentioned here is what have we lost. I read an article back in the early 90s. And this article stated that in 1948, if you graduated out of high school, you had the equivalent well-rounded education of a college graduate at that time. And I thought, I'm not sure I believe that. But then I happened on to, I think it was 1873, an eighth grade exam that you had to pass in order to get from eighth grade to high school. And I'll tell you what, folks, I don't know if I could pass that exam. Unbelievably hard. But that's the academic side. That's not the skill side. The Proposition 5 was mentioned here. Proposition 5, what I see is that we're trying to regulate and administer locally a pre-Proposition 5 attitude with a post-Proposition 5 environment. I'm seeing that. Very, very difficult to do. Local people get elected to boards and things of this nature, but actually, who's the one that tells you how much money you have? It's us. So, my question to this, have we figured out how much No Child Left Behind actually costs the state? Because I believe we get about $1 billion per biennium, maybe it's a year, I think it's maybe, that's a biennium, on federal money. What is it actually costing us? Does anyone know? So, those are the comments I had.
In your other role,
I will put on my quality education council hat, and I'm going to have to get back. I will give you a more detailed answer because it's a very good question. There's really two parts of the question. One is, what is the assessment system associated with the act cost, and there is funding for that, and it's not as much as the dollars received from the federal government. But the larger, more difficult question is, what would it cost to achieve the standards suggested by that act, which would be to raise the bar to a level of, again, a very, very high level. And I would tell you, to achieve that, we have not been able to establish what that number would be. It would be a very large number, because the act is, we got a very ambitious goal, which is all students over the next decade or so would hit these standards that we as a state have established. And we're not at it yet, and we know that there's a lot of work that we need to get done in the schools. Schools, we need more money, frankly. They need more school class sizes, more professional development, a lot of resources to get all students to those standards. And we have not documented what that number would be. We've tried. We may have some, I'll talk with Brian Reeder, we may have some estimate, I can't recall, but it's a big number. But again, that speaks to the larger question of what are our collective goals for education, and what are we willing to pay for enough resources to get there? Because while schools are doing a great job with the resources they have, the reality is it takes, resources do matter in terms of hitting for students to hit the standards we want. No.
Representative Wilsmith, we're going to go to Representative Dahlin, and then we'll bring the remaining batters on deck as well. And I would take the liberty to insert here, Mr. Duncan, that I am seeing more and more information documented and printed that, given the revenue challenge for every state in this country, the dialogue has been turning more to not so much it's the number or the amount that of the revenue, but how those resources are utilized. So I'm hoping that we can also pivot on that debate as well.
I understand that, absolutely.
Representative Dahlin.
Thank you. And I have four questions that I hope will be easily answered, but they would be preceded by a long diatribe.
The status quo. I thought we were moving beyond that.
Last year, at this time, before I had served in the legislature, it was easy because I had all the answers. I mean, all of them, particularly in education. Since then, I have become dumber and dumber and dumber to the point. And I honestly believe in the last session, I heard all the cliches. If you want to blame, there's a playful. I look around the room here, and I see some people that I violently agreed with, and that. But when it all boiled away, what I found, particularly after we left Portland, and we too had a public meeting, the chair and I spent hours talking about where direction would go. And I found that when we talked about Sim and Cam, our definition of Sim and Cam was different than the people we were talking to about Sim and Cam. When we talked about policy and setting policy, our definition of what policy was different than their definition. In fact, when I look at your white paper, it raised some questions immediately. And the board is mindful that local school districts are responsible for delivering education services. So I would ask, I think in this room, we have a fairly good understanding that a SIM is not simply a credential. A sim is what leads up to getting that credential. In public testimony, a sim was a piece of paper that you took to the beach and burned because it had absolutely no value. So, in my mind, the disconnect between our discussion of a sim and public testimony of a sim has now been resolved for me. But one that I would ask you to define is, the board is mindful that local school districts are responsible for delivering education service districts, or pardon me, education services, and our job is to set policy. So I want to know, specifically, before we go a lot further, is there a consensus on what policy is and what delivering education service might be?
Is there a consensus? We haven't discussed that question, but I think so. I think when we say that local school district is responsible for delivering education service, we mean the actual on-the-ground work that gets instruction to youngsters and assesses it and moves them through, and that our job is to guide that, inspire it with regulations, rules, helps, incentives that will forward that. That's my definition. Now we'll find out if we have.
I actually think it's really what you were talking about earlier. I think in your remarks, Representative Donald, not sure if it's in Donald, what you're raising is a very large question of governance. What is the proper role for state government in relation to school districts? And I think, as earlier said, that is a huge question which we have never fully answered as a state. And I think it's a very important one. But I think underlying both this work and the Quality Ed Commission, what we talked about this a lot, is that the role of the state is to, one, set standards, to set a set of measurement systems to ensure that we know how well students are doing, and then to provide adequate resources so schools have the opportunity to educate kids to meet those standards. What the role of the state is not to do is to direct how money should be spent in a detailed way, or to design specific curriculum to meet the standards. If there needs to be flexibility on the ground so that school districts have that flexibility to meet standards in the way they feel is most appropriate. So, and then the accountability comes in the reporting back of how well they do in meeting standards and as well as indicating how they spend their money. But I think that's generally what the conversation has been. But we have frankly never articulated that as well as I think we need to, and necessarily redefined our own roles and responsibilities around that. But I do, because I think it's a huge important question, and post Measure 5, the funding responsibilities changed. The Education Act was passed, and we've assumed different roles at the state than in the past.
Oh, hold on a second. I'm fine, Duncan. We usually agree when you say that one end of the table. Most of the people in this room that I've visited with, we agree. But if then policy is to set standards, do we care at your level, State Board of Ed, or at this level, the House Committee on Education, whether we use outcome-based education or Carnegie unit-based education to meet those standards? Do we have a compelling interest in how our schools get there if policy is to set the standards?
Interesting question. Yeah. I'm going to write that one. It's part of our feedback.
Do we care how they get there? If you set the standards and they achieve the standards as measured by our assessment, we have this fight over what the assessment is, but if they meet the standards, do we care how they get there?
I'm sure we'll hear that.
My answer to that would be no.
We don't care.
The state probably does have a role to assist districts. The big question is where does accountability fall then when districts don't meet it?
Mm-hmm.
That becomes the question, and what does the state do or not do? But if, as a state, we'd be as a state, we don't like the feds telling us what to do.
the locals don't like the state telling them what to do, etc. That's the push and tug. But I don't think if the schools meet the objective and meet the standard, then I'd say that's great.
Perhaps I'm directing this question to the wrong group, but there are questions that I want to contemplate. If we do not meet the standards as established by the federal government, which we establish ourselves, in No Child Left Behind, what happens to us?
Well,
we don't get the money. Is that the answer?
No.
Well, under the federal guidelines, there is a whole series of steps associated with the schools in terms of progressive, discipline to the point where schools have to have open enrollment policies and so on. That's the way that the federal laws, I understand it, is designed. The question you're raising is really what is the accountability tools available at the federal level when schools, as
Joyce
says, are performing.
So I want to go with this conversation and ask you these questions, not because I expect to answer so much, but the questions I've been asking myself. With the original Oregon Education Act, the issue was, and the example I was given was, can a kindergartner tie his shoes? You don't care whether the kindergarten learned to tie his shoes at home, in preschool, or in kindergarten. The issue was, when we said it's time to tie shoes, could all of them do it? Is that where we want to go? I think is the discussion we had with the Oregon Education Act and said, yes, that's where we want to go. But then we continue with, and I'm not sure, I want you to tell me what our part in the play is. We continue with the Carnegie standards, the outcome-based standards, and we put schools in an interesting position of having to do not one, but two things we want them to do, and the two are not congruent. They're absolutely incongruent. So I would ask you to tell me what I can do as a legislator from House District 59 to make this more of a policy issue for schools. That's what I'd ask you to do.
Madam Chair, Representative Dowling, I think that's what we're struggling with when we set the standards for high school graduation. Mm-hmm. What are intended consequences? And I would suggest we have to look, what are the unintended consequences of whatever we adopt? I think the concept of what you did last session, more math, more English, makes sense. Some districts, and we can argue that the resources are not, it may end up with fewer electives. That may be an unintended consequence. And that is what we're struggling with of any time anybody sets standards. We probably agree on where we're headed, but what happens when we implement it may vary and may have, I'd say, look at unintended consequences on anything we adopt.
One last follow-up.
This is my last shot. Having you reference that example, I feel a little like Pony Possum. I have found the enemy, and he is me.
Mm-hmm.
That's my question.
Stimulate to that. Madam Chair, Representative, this is such an important question. I can't say, and it really is embedded in the whole conversation on the white paper. I mean, what we have in this state is a series of standards and assessments which we use to measure how schools are doing. We also have, and I think this is really important and not been neglected, we have the database project, which I can go and show you how every single school spends this money in the state in pretty good detail. It's not perfect, but it's really good. And it's one of the first in the country. So you can showcase the performance and spending in every school. So the idea I think we've been talking about, and again, it needs to arguably be clear to everyone, is the state establishes what we want the learning outcomes to be. We budget to those outcomes. We say, this is the amount of money we think it takes to achieve these results. and then we leave it to the schools to decide how to spend the money. And as Jerry says, if they meet the results, we celebrate. We showcase those schools. We celebrate. The issue arises with those schools that aren't doing well with the resources and they're doing less well. And then how do interventions make sense? And that's the big accountability question which we have to raise. And that's frankly an issue that has not really been fully resolved. But if that becomes your way of thinking, the role of all of us at the state level is to set the performance targets and the budgets and to give a great deal of flexibility and not to try to direct schools on how they should do their business so much as saying if you're meeting the standards, and we'll say as well safety standards and all the other things we care about, but if you're meeting the standards, give flexibility to move. I think that is the philosophic underpinning of the role of the state in relation to the schools.
I can see we're all making a list for our next discussion. Before I move to Representative Roland, and we talked, Mr. Wise, about the data that's available, and assuming that you're using the DBI to extrapolate that. I think one of the areas of concern that we addressed or heard testimony during the session was is that some of that information is between 18 and 24 months old by the time that it's available for that type of use. So,
correct. That's a problem.
Not a criticism, just a comment.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, it's a criticism, and hopefully we move forward.
Yeah, it's right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to follow along on a little bit of the line that Representative Dahlin was going on. And I really appreciate the white paper. I appreciate, for the first time, I think that the State Board and others have articulated the idea of how complex it is at the secondary level with the multiple systems that are in place. Because I think that's, and it's part of the acknowledgement of why there's a harder time at the high school. Because in elementary, you can take the standards and you can align the curriculum because you are in control of that whole curriculum. Whereas at the secondary level, you aren't in control because higher ed has said there are certain things you want with respect to the Carnegie unit, and it makes it easier for them to evaluate a transcript if it has those things, as opposed to the standards. So that you can't pick a course and say, this course is addressing the standard, whether it be math or English and so on. And that discrepancy has created a lot of internal turmoil, and it's one of the issues that goes to what Representative Esquivel was saying. Teachers have a responsibility to design a curriculum in their course and assess that course to give a grade at the end of their Carnegie unit. At the same time, they're asked by the state to build into that another assessment system that's going to be on top of it, which they feel responsible for, that's going to assess in two ways. One, to get them back information on the standards. And two, to be used to assess the school's performance, which was the other thing you addressed, which I appreciate, because it is there are two different systems. And the one that irritates me the most when No Child came into being is that we took our system that was built on a continuous improvement model and stuck it into a standards-based model that said, here's the standard. So we took wherever the standards were and we said, here's the bar, which wasn't really the bar that we'd really intended. It was the bar we needed to have because the federal government was asking us to do something, and we didn't want to change our system. We didn't really want to look at it, which is what you're doing now, and which I commend you on because you need to do that. Because our goal was to continuously improve our student performance, and that there wasn't a limit to that improvement. And now there is. Now there is the standard that we've set for each of these different places. And if we get there, we're really happy with ourselves. And the real, I think, visionary thing in our system that we put back in 93 and 92 was the fact that there wouldn't be a limit. Our expectation was we would always be striving to have our kids be better and more prepared depending on whatever happened. And now we've locked it in at a standard that may or may not be the right one. We haven't really addressed that issue. We've never really looked at it. And so I hope that as you go through this process, you evaluate, are the standards that we've put in place to evaluate schools, i.e. the ones that we beat ourselves up over when we get our report card from the federal government on the schools, are those the standards we really wanted to have for that system? And if not, should we set up another level there and still have our progress? I don't know if we want to have all three. And along with his deal, how do we get to the point where we get rid of one or two of these systems and start saying, here are the proficiencies that we need. Here's what you need to do at a high school to meet those. And you're going going to get, like you try to do, you get your credits when you've met that proficiency, so that they end up doing and passing this class. I mean, it goes back to the whole idea of apprenticeships and so on. The teacher is the best person to know what the student can truly do, just like the craftsman was working with that student alongside of them. And they do know whether that student can perform or not. And if they truly know what the standard is and what they expect, and they hold to it. And that was one of the problems with the Carnegie system that was being broken, was that we lowered that because we wanted more people to get through. So we got that D became lower and lower, and that eventually affected the C got lower and lower because we wanted everybody to get through, and we weren't holding anything constant. So somehow we've got to hold the standard constant, and I guess I just want to hear input on this. Hold the standards constant and expect and figure out ways to get the kids there. So along with that, I guess my hope is that through looking at your paper, I see some hope that you're going to give some direction to us about some of those issues. And I'll just leave it open to any comments. Thanks.
Madam Chair, Representative Logan, I think you have a state board that is committed to come up with ideas, policies that we think make sense for the state, that we're gladly going to share with you, and you can do with it what you wish, because we think it's our responsibility to review the system and come up with policies that make sense. And as one member of the state board, if you don't buy it, that's your prerogative not to buy it. And I think that's what we want to do. That I think that's the seven members of the state board. We've been very upfront on we have the responsibility. We're not going to say no. It's a legislator's responsibility to do that, or OEA to do that, or whatever. We have a responsibility. We give it our best shot. People buy it or they don't buy it. We argue with you, or whatever we do, to try to reach consensus for the state of what makes sense. And that's really what we're trying to struggle with. And you have, I know you have seven board members that strongly believe that's our role, with all the things that come with that.
I'm sure that's encouraging because we struggle in the same way, and it's glad that we can struggle together now. I'm liking this. Representative Comte.
Thank you, and I thought Representative Wilson has been waiting patiently. Okay. Well, I just had a couple of comments, and first of all, I really appreciate the feel that I'm getting about collaboration, because none of us have all the answers, or else it wouldn't be done. I just wanted to follow up on Representative Avakian's question about, you know, what about these federal mandates? There's nobody, and the principals, though, Representative Roblin and I as a middle school principal, and what Representative Roblin experiences as a high school principal, are very, very difficult times, because I was in a school that is low performing. And the reality is, in 1990, when Measure 5 was implemented, at that time, we didn't have an inclusive model of special education students in our classrooms. That came through the federal government at that time. So what maybe some of our, even, I don't know when Representative Avakian graduated, I know he's younger than I am, but you know, we didn't have special ed kids in our classrooms. Since 1990, those students are in our classrooms, accepted as learning peers. The other big change in a district such as House District 22 would be in North Salem. In 1990, maybe 25% of our students were learning English as a second language. Now, in my school, in Woodbury School District, 70% of the students that are staying next to each other in the classrooms are learning English as a second language. Therefore, the question comes up as a school principal when you're frustrated about federal requirements and lousy test scores or whatever, and Representative Escobar tried to pull the figure out of his brain, but we get over $2 billion in the state from the federal government. Yet, my site council wanted to go to our superintendent and say, enough, we don't want the money. It would have cost us four teachers in our school. It's not worth it. It is absolutely not worth it. But is the rest of the state there saying that we're going to give up $2 billion of federal funding? That's a lot of money. And the only comment, and that's my pedestal or my soapbox I'm standing on today, federalism versus, the old way, that I really, really believe in proficiency, performance-based education. And I really appreciate your point of number four over here on the statewide assessments, because the statewide assessments really where the rubber seems to hit the road for most educators that think about it at high school. Coming from a middle school background, I started out of high school and then went to middle school. I feel some of the most precious gems in our system are being lost. And we do a lot for the underperformance student, but the challenged student. But we're not challenging our talented and gifted students. In here, on number four, it says that we're going to provide instruction for students to advance as fast as they choose and additional instruction. I was told by high school administrators time after time, well, you can't send that student up to the high school because, you just can't. We don't have enough classroom space, whatever. Well, I'm not one to listen to the word can't. And so then I would work with parents in order to make sure that their talented, gifted students receive the services they're entitled to. I had a high school say, you can't send the student up here to take calculus from in the seventh grade because what will she get when she gets here? And I said, who says she's going to get there? That very student was accepted at the University of Washington as an eighth grader. And we're holding those children back. And then the other thing the high school, I wish you'd look at is, in your proficiency-based assessments, if that student can pass that calculus class, why in the world aren't they getting high school credit for it? Right now we have three full sections of students in our eighth grade. Our eighth grade is about, 150 to 180 students. And we have three classes, that's an equivalent of approximately 75 to 90 students that are taking high school math but will not receive the credit. Why? I mean, to me, those are the questions we need to answer when we're looking at proficiency-based assessments. And, I think we've done a good job at making sure that our high school people, juniors and seniors, can earn college credit. But there's no incentive for a middle school student to go in and fight the hallways in the high school. You get the learning, but where's the trade-off? Where's the academic credit behind it? So you're going to hear me advocate over and over for talented and gifted students in this room because the loss is great. We can't afford to lose that loss in our state. So that's the piece I'd really like to see to work on and see if we can't get some uniformity or at least some recommendations for those types of things for even middle school students.
Madam Chair, Representative Gump, and I'm not being flippant. Sometimes I get flippant. The school district can do that right now. Nothing is stopping any school district from having a second grader or a fifth grader or a seventh grader get advanced credit based on the performance of that individual. So I don't know quite how, and we're going to, so there is local autonomy and control, and where that student goes in that K through 12 is up to that local school district.
Just to follow up on it. And I agree with you. I have fought this internally, and I guess that's why I want to take it to another level. And particularly, is this happening in other districts? Are there models out there that we can bring to districts that haven't been accepting of that? Because I don't want to mandate it, but it is within our local prerogative that it's not happening.
Madam Chair, I think that I'm so glad you raised that issue because I think one of the key points on the whole design of the system, and it needs to be flexible for all students. We're talking about all students. This needs to be a system that measures and assesses and helps all, and it needs to help all students gain regularly. It shouldn't be about simply setting a benchmark, and if you get the benchmark, it's the end of the story. We need a system that creates the expectation that every student will gain every year.
Exactly.
And then there will be system design issues that follow. How do you create a system that enables that to happen for kids who happen to be talented and want to move, and maybe rather than moving on to high school, you move the high school quickly into the middle school, or whatever, maybe different ways to navigate to deal with the social issues. But I think that is part of the design question we all need to be asking as we look at whatever we all collectively come up with here, because it's a worrying, it's a, about science-based reform. If we're not careful, you really can lose a lot if you don't feel insensitive to what you raise. So
thank
really
you.
Appreciate
thank
that.
I think part of the discussion on tracking the individual student will be something we'll focus on when we have the department before us as well, probably our next meeting. So we'll be fleshing that out somewhat as well. So I think that's helpful. And I know you wanted to insert something very quickly before we move to Representative Rizzo.
I would like to address two questions that were raised. We do have a system. In fact, I think education, we can drive geometry into the fifth grade, and many schools have.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean an elementary geometry would understand. That's geometry by any definition. We can drive algebra into the eighth grade, and many schools have. But we now have legislation that says that before a student can graduate, they must have 3 years of math. Well, if we have a school that has driven geometry into the fifth grade, algebra into the eighth grade, that means that our schools are going to have to teach calculus, introduction to the calculus, probably trig, and courses that are of little or no value to anybody. So my statement to you... my statement to you is, I want you to tell us what we have to do, and I want to be able to tell you where we should be. We have created a system that does a wonderful job of preserving the status quo. The second area that I wanted to address, and this was from Representative Esquivel, when No Child Left Behind money first clattered onto the table, in the school district I served, it meant 14 people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no way that I was going to let my representative at that time turn his back on No Child Left Behind. It wasn't a matter of saving art and band.
Yeah.
It was a matter of saving math and social studies and English, or at least saving them in class sizes that I could be humbly embarrassed about at the Kiwanis Club. But the point here is I would like us to work much more closely together. I have been party to sending you some rules that I wondered about. But I think, and I'm going to say it again, as I look around the room, there are many parties in here. We all have one goal, and we swear by it. But we do some things that are very counterproductive to reaching that goal. And if you'll tell me what I'm doing, I will work hard to straighten it out.
Thank you, Representative Donnelly. Representative Rosemont.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, let me thank all of you for what you're doing. You are volunteers, and we shouldn't forget that. My wife's job at Summer Resort is recruiting a bunch of volunteers. Anyone wants to come out next year and help her with her golf tournaments, she would love to have you. So I salute you for your effort. And I guess a couple of direct questions I had, and one thing I'd like to say that in my experience working with education in Oregon for the last couple of sessions is I'd like to see the board more active and activist. And based upon that, Mr. Squire said that you will be giving us a recommendation on what to do with SIM and CHEM. And could you please tell us when that is? Is that going to be after this study when you would receive the recommendation? And the other part of that, you also mentioned that our diploma just says a diploma, and other states do have, like, the, you know, with honors or whatever, and is that something we could look into? Thank you.
Chair Flores, Representative Rosemont.
You may expect that we will come forward with a set of recommendations based on the results of this work we're doing that address both of those questions and others as well. Our timeline is we've had the paper with all of the questions and other issues that it naturally generates out before the public now throughout the fall. Tomorrow is the deadline date for the first round of comments. We expect to have a summary of those at our January meeting. And based on that, we'll do some reframing here, probably some narrowing and some more clear leanings. We'll take another round of public comment. By summer, early fall, we will be working on final recommendations to bring forward for the 2007 session. It will include our best thinking about all of the topics that are laid out here that are areas where the legislature needs to be involved. And it also will include our recommendations and best thinking for those areas where we or some other organization has the prerogative to move forward. We're very interested in working together on a legislative package that addresses these key issues. We intend to have our work on the high school graduation requirements completed by this time next year. We have work to do that you gave us in the last session relative to the additional requirements. We're trying to look at that in a little more expansive way. Are we talking only about units? Are we talking about proficiencies that are embedded in those units? What do we really want this to be?
Madam Chair.
So I think the short answer is yes.
Okay.
Follow up?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. You said you won't have the recommendations until this time.
Next year.
Next year, so that means it would be another legislative session on the graduation requirements.
We expect to have changed the high school graduation requirement by this time next year based on our work to the degree that we are enabled to do that. That's our plan timeline.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just have a couple comments and a question myself. If everyone has...
Yeah, question.
Please. Go.
Could you just briefly discuss what you're doing, if any, with regard to IB and AP courses in high schools?
Go ahead. Okay, I mean, it's all part of the conversation. Of course, we raise it in the paper, and we're getting lots of comments of how to integrate those certificates with the rest of the certificates. We haven't really talked with you, and again, let me just briefly, the outreach has been really quite extensive. I know we've all had participated in different forms, both with K-12 folks, but I think it's very important. We've also involved the community colleges and the higher ed and the employers, so that we're trying to look at this, not just because, again, the whole theme here is how does the whole system work, and we're trying to look at all the credentials. I happened to meet with the director of the International Baccalaureate Program and had a long conversation with him about and how it ties, and encouraged them to give us comments. I don't know if they will. We're getting a lot of feedback on this paper.
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, I might add to that a good deal of that kind of work is being done by the department in cooperation with local school districts, incentive grants, demonstration projects, those kinds of things. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan McComb, who's executive assistant of the board, just gave to me this morning, and I haven't had a chance to look at it. Here is a 59-page reaction to the white paper from an individual. Happens to be from Corvallis. Here's another one from an individual in Condon that is about 35 pages.
Wow.
And that's not from an association. Those, it looks like, the individuals that have that concerned. So I think we're going to get some interesting data based on the paper to ruminate, and it's not going to be an easy task, but I think the board is willing to take it on, and we will be coming as Chairperson Squire said, with ideas, recommendations, and working on it.
Wise, when you were kind of giving your introduction to the white paper and the, some of the pre-1990-91 legislation, that you stated students were not meeting standards to move to college, and then we're facing the same dilemma today with the implementation of that new act, when you're talking about not being prepared, that so much, and I'm sure, Mr. Berger, you acknowledge that so many community college students come for remediation. Some four-year institution freshmen are needing remediation. We're talking about the standards, and you indicated that Tuna Squire is about graduating with a D and still not getting a diploma and still not being ready to enter. So, interesting full circle, I think. So I'm so thankful that you are engaging this particular dialogue at this time. I think it expresses a lot of our frustrations as well. When you indicated that you have about an outreach to about a million folks, do you have any sense of the type of response that you're getting? Because I have a couple myself, and this one's kind of lengthy, from an individual as well. So I'm hopeful that when you mentioned that you talk within the education circles and you talk to employers or businesses, that you are also having access and input from parents.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any sense of numbers at all?
I'm digging through, I don't know if you have, excuse me, Chair Flores, members of the committee. I'm not sure if your materials include this most recent summary of the response to the communications plan that Jan McComb gave me. We have had, I'm looking for the date on this. This is a fairly recent update. It's been kind of a rolling. We've had 200 responses on our web survey. We have talked directly face-to-face with 916 people about the white paper, and they've included folks from all walks of life. And we've reached over a million people with our request. And then there's a list here, perhaps you would like to have it, of the groups with which the policy paper has been discussed in a kind of face-to-face conversation, the groups to which we have sent a formal request for comments, and then Jan has been summarizing the responses to the web posting as they come in. I don't really have a sense right now of an overall direction because we really aren't to that point in the process yet. Some of us have been reading individual things as they come along. But as a board, we've been waiting for the first deadline to come and the summary to be done, and then we'll take a look at it together. How about the rest of you?
Yes, Representative Flores, there have been a number of opportunities to visit, and I think Chair Squire played out in the grocery store. And this afternoon is somewhat indicative. On my way back to Baker City this afternoon, I'll be visiting with people in Arlington and Cromston. So it doesn't have near the penetration that we'd hoped as far as responses, but it is generating interest around the city.
I think, Madam Chair, we have a list we'll share with you. I can think of three. I've participated in the garden here. I think there's a lot of conversation, but I also say part of the leadership we collectively need to undertake this year is, I think the next round is going to be really important. It takes a while to penetrate all the audiences we need to penetrate to really build this conversation. And again, our hope is by the time we're done, we will have a renewed sense of energy and enthusiasm around what we want to create here. And to do that, we've got to engage a lot of Oregonians and a lot of people who have worked very hard on the current system and see the challenges and problems and want to make it better. And I think, as Nikki has said, there's some cynicism out there about when you go in and say, look, the board's doing a policy review. Oh, you're not really doing a policy review. You know what you're going to do. And we really are doing a policy review. And it may take a while for that to penetrate. And my guess is more and more folks will come along as we keep talking about this. And in that regard, anything you can do in your own districts or however you want to connect. I appreciate, for example, someone had said, Representative Flores, that you'd asked them to comment on the bike. That really helps a lot. You know, if you can direct people and tell them that you're going to be looking at the results too, that really helps all of us, I think, build the understanding. This is time to really get engaged, and that's what we need to do.
Well, thank you. I know that I speak for, and I'm certain I speak for the entire committee when I express an appreciation for the work that you're undertaking, and certainly for coming today. It's quite an honor. And also to hopefully we can continue the collaborative dialogue, and if you'd like to invite us to one of your board meetings, we'd be happy to be there, unreimbursed, of course. Thank you very much, and please feel free to contact any and or all of us at any time you feel the need to.
Thank you very much for inviting us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I see that we are doing pretty well as far as keeping to a schedule, so we will recess for a lunch period. We will resume at 1:30. The second portion of our day, we will now come to order the House Interim Committee on Education. And this afternoon, we're going to be talking about an issue that came publicly to our attention by virtue of a headline above the fold. And as a consequence of that, the House Interim Committee on Education scheduled this time to gather some facts pertaining to the oversight authority, audit responsibility, and system accountability for education service districts. We are not here to attempt to adjudicate this matter or to go into any level of that nature. In your notebooks, committee members, you will have copies of letters that I had sent to the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, the Government Standards and Practices Commission, requesting a response to four questions. I've also invited the Oregon Department of Education and the Oregon School Boards Association to provide information. With that in mind, I would then like to proceed according to our listing of the invited testimony to have teachers representative from Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and we see Vicki Chamberlain. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Teacher Standards and Practices. I needed to get out of the low chair, sorry.
Move mics however you feel. I think we got a little technical glitch there.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I took the questions from the letter that you sent me and answered them, and if you have questions along the way, great, but thought that was a good place to start and see where we go. Your first question was based on the public information or any other information you may have received. Will TSPC conduct any investigation or inquiry of the Willamette ESD? And the answer to that question is no, because we don't have the jurisdiction to investigate an entity or a school district. Our jurisdiction goes exclusively to licensed educators. So there's a couple pieces to your question. It's that one of our statutes, ORS 342-176, which I put in your packet,
says that upon receipt of complaint or information that a person has violated statutes within our statutes, the TSPC shall promptly undertake an investigation. So before I get into details about that, since there were licensed persons mentioned in the article and we had not received a formal complaint or other information, that's information upon which we can act. And we do act, actually, in other situations when we come by the information, by the news. I think it would be, I'll come back to the second paragraph there and explain that more, because I think there's a couple of other questions on there that help me get to that a little bit better. So we would not, in conclusion, investigate the ESD, but we would investigate the licensed educators. So then your second question is, if the answer to question one is yes, please describe the scope of an investigation or inquiry. So I stretch that. Yes, we will be investigating licensed educators, and the scope of the inquiry will be whether there's sufficient evidence for us to charge them with violating actually the standards that are in statute, which we've defined by rule. And if you look in your packet, on the very back one, the administrative rules, this is the division that holds the ethical standards that we look at. But the one that we look at most closely and that may govern in this area, you'll find, begins at the bottom of page 9 and extends through page 10. So if you would go to the bottom of page 9 for me, it says in subparagraph 4, gross neglect of duty is actually the conduct that we look at most often for educators. It's any serious and material inattention to a breach of professional responsibilities. And then each of the subsections go on, for example, knowing the unauthorized use of school equipment, knowing the substantial unauthorized use of employment time, falsifying documents, including applications, unreasonable force, sexual conduct with a student, et cetera, et cetera. So that may be helpful. But prior to that division are other standards of conduct that we insist upon that also may come into play when we do an investigation. So we look to see if there's evidence from the investigation sufficient to charge an educator with having violated the ethical standards that are laid out in our administrative rules. If we do have sufficient evidence to charge an educator, we give them, the commission reviews the investigation report in a closed executive session, and if the commission determines that there's sufficient evidence to charge, then they will notify the educator that we're going to charge them with violating, and then they have a right to an administrative hearing on, they can present their side of the evidence of whether they believe they've committed a violation or not. Question 3 says, if there is an investigation inquiry, will the information be made available to the public? Well, when our rules were set up 35 years ago, and I think this is consistent with all licensure boards, it says the answer to this is going to depend on the outcome. If the investigation determines that there is sufficient evidence to charge an educator with a violation, then we may disclose the documents. If the evidence says that there is not sufficient evidence to charge them, then the statute is very clear. It says the documents and materials used in the investigation and the report of the executive director to the commission are confidential and not subject to public inspection. And we permanently lock those up in archives, and they're not disclosable. On the flip side of that, once the commission reaches a final order, if they have charged an educator, then the investigation report and materials become available to the public. Question 4. If the TSPC is not conducting an inquiry, please advise why not. Well, not investigating at this point is not a legal option for us, because our statutes say very clearly that upon receipt of a complaint or information that a person has violated our statutes, the TSPC shall promptly undertake an investigation. And while we can't determine just by looking at the information that the allegation is an actual violation. We can determine by looking at the information that there's sufficient cause to do an investigation to see if they have done a violation. So if once we have the complaint, once we have the investigation, it's not an option not to investigate, I think is what I'm trying to say here. The only other thing I was going to explain that I didn't explain earlier is that 342.143 refers to a statute that says that if educators are convicted of certain crimes, we're required to take their license away from them, and that's what that statute's about. And then 342.175 is a statute that lays out that if we find that they are guilty of gross neglect of duty or guilty of gross unfitness, then we have the option of either reprimanding them, putting them on probation, suspending their license, or revoking their license. In any case, it may be important for you to know that if they're not convicted of a crime in 342.143, the most the commission can suspend or revoke a license is 1 year. However, the statute does say that the educator has to prove that they have fitness to come back and teach or be an educator. They have to prove to us that they're entitled to get their license back, and they are able to apply for it after 1 year.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative
Bob? I want to back up just a little bit and talk about the process for filing a complaint. If I'm a member of the general public, what process do I go through, and to TSPC, what constitutes a legitimate complaint? How do I get into the system?
It's really very, Chair Flores, Representative Dallum, it's really very easy. Generally, most people call us, or they'll write a letter. And what we do is my executive assistant, who is the coordinator of the discipline function, will contact them back and either mail them a complaint form or direct them to a complaint form on the web. And they almost always fill it out. They, like 99% of the time, they fill it out and send it back. That is a, we would consider a patron complaint or someone from the public. Then it gets assigned to an investigator and it moves through the process. Occasionally, as I mentioned when I sat down, we will get information from a newspaper article and I will institute the investigation or I will ask for the investigation, and that's what I did in this case. And then, not to leave a part unanswered, there is a reporting requirement for the chief administrator of every district to report to us if they believe there's been violations of the standards.
Yes, but this may be a lot to ask, but could you give us some notion of the number of complaints that you handle in a year? And if possible, their origin. We've talked about yourself from the newspaper, patrons from the district that have concerns about an educator or professional's conduct, and then administrators in their annual report. How many do you get, and what's the breakdown on those?
We generally handle somewhere in the neighborhood of 189 to 220 cases a year. That's the number we dispose of. We right now have 177 pending cases, and about 60% of them come from districts, and about 40% of them come from patrons. And I would say that less than 2% come from information.
So typically you're notified from the district in one fashion, and far more often than they're reading the newspaper.
Representative Down, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Further questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me, I was lapsing my duties to acknowledge that we have Senator Walker and Representative Berger joining us today, and we appreciate that very much.
And Madam Chair, appreciate you, and I know Senator Walker does too, your willingness to have a sit, and this is a concern. If I could, Mrs. Chamberlain, do I take it to mean from this letter that you have opened an investigation as a result of newspaper, reading the newspaper, if you will?
Chair Flores, Representative Berger, the answer is yes. I did request that investigations be opened on this case.
Additional questions, Representative Wisnik?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Chamberlain, did your agency revoke any license from the Baker Union ESD people involved in the incident 2 years ago?
Chair Flores, Representative Wisnik, we have not resolved those cases yet, and that's a great question to discuss why not. That situation has been under criminal investigation and other investigation from federal authorities and state authorities, and we almost never act on a license until those investigations are resolved, frequently because it will inform the outcome. So, for example, if they're convicted of a crime, it would direct one direction of action for us. If they're not convicted of a crime, it would direct another action for us. So if we acted ahead of them, we would have to undo our action if the criminal investigation was different. And they have not yet totally resolved that criminal investigation.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mrs. Cheney. I guess I'm a little concerned about that. Senator Walker and I yesterday talked about Dr. Patel's case where, you know, he sort of fell through the cracks. And I guess that would be something I'd be concerned about if it was a serious violation. It wasn't anything to do with abuse or anything in the case in Baker Union as far as children, but it was. Say there was a child abuse situation like that, looks like you'd want to suspend their license temporarily or something like that instead of just waiting until the criminal investigation's over.
Chair Flores, Representative Wisnant, the statutes give us the authority to do that or to act and do that very quickly. I have not yet in the 3.5 years that I've been here found a situation where the district did not immediately suspend or fire or otherwise have the person removed from contact with students. And fortunately, in the most egregious cases, they often end up in jail immediately, which is also protective. But we do pay attention if there is a report of student inappropriate boundaries or student contact. Those cases float to the top instantly and would take precedent over something that appears to be administrative or paperwork or something oriented.
All right, Madam Chair.
All right.
Thank you. Last question. How are your staff trained for this investigation? Is there special training to investigate? Because, to me, it seems like it's a very specific type of training to investigate and interview people. It would not be a normal teacher's background.
Chair Flores, Representative Wisnant, both of my investigators, I have 1.5 investigators, are former police officers and are very well trained in investigation techniques.
Thank you.
Representative Dahl.
I want to be sure that I understand. When it comes to Representative Wisnant was talking about putting a child in jeopardy, the first line of defense to protect their children is the district. And if the district doesn't act, then there is recourse to you. If the district does act, there is still recourse to you because you're going to examine the case adjudicated on merits against standards, and then you react. So you are the second line of defense, but our primary protectors are at home.
Chair Flores, Representative Dallin, that's correct. And people often get confused with the employment discipline versus the licensure discipline. And in fact, they may satisfactorily resolve the employment discipline, but it may not be resolved satisfactorily to us. And we do not rely exclusively or overly heavily on an outcome in a district. We will absolutely use an investigation report, but sometimes administrators are very lenient, and we may have concerns, and that's actually proved to be well-founded, and sometimes they're not, and their discipline would parallel something that would result. But for example, a district may not find something egregious enough to have the person be unemployed. We may find it egregious enough to suspend their license, which would mean they would have to be unemployed because they can't work without the license. That happens occasionally. It's not the rule.
Then I'm going back to the due process piece. How do these pieces get into your system? Let's assume that a district has settled a discipline issue with a professional staff member, and as far as they're concerned, it's over, but you have some issues. How does that enter the system? What's the entry point there?
Well,
on these few cases.
Representative Chair Forge, Representative Dallum, there's certainly situations where we may not hear of them, where they resolve a discipline case and not refer it to the commission. But we do spend a lot of time with administrators trying to educate them. They have a duty to report any belief of a violation, and that includes theft of money, driving under the influence, the conviction of any crime, anything that's on that list in on pages 9 and 10 in those rules I was showing you, use of internet pornography or anything like that. It's a requirement that the superintendent report the possibility that there's been a violation of the standards to us for an investigate. And maybe most superintendents over-report, and that we have a fair amount of recommendations of no further action because the evidence doesn't support that there's been a violation that would merit action on the license.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Further questions? Mrs. Chamberlain, at what point would information on a past employment history? I'm sorry, Senator Walker, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to respond to Representative Wisney when he was asking about teachers being put on leave if there was abuse. We did pass a bill last session, and Representative Flores and I worked diligently on Senate Bill 755, and it does place any school employee on leave if there's a credible report of child sex abuse. So we have passed that in this building, and that's being implemented, and we are trying to protect our children. So I just wanted to let you know we did pass that last session, and all of the thousands of bills we look at, it's easy to overlook those.
What else you did?
Yeah, you did. And I did want to thank the chair because she worked very hard with me on that bill.
And thank you for bringing that up. Back to my question, at what point would the past employment history of someone be brought to your attention, and then as a follow-up to that information conveyed to a potential employer? An employment history in which there had been complaints.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to think about how this would work. If we open an investigation, the first thing that gets subpoenaed from that employer is their employment file. And our AG has ruled that that is as protected in our office as it is, for example, in the school district's office. And I'm hoping this is the gist of your question. The issue I think that we have run into recently that we're dealing with is how does a new employer know whether or not there have been previous TSPC actions? The system to understand what happens with employment comes through reference checks, and that's, as we know, generally flawed, but we don't have a great system for connecting prior disciplines with new employment, and that's actually something we're actively working on right now because we have public access to people's licensure files, and what I have our IT contractor working on is how when districts can get in anytime they hire and look at the licensee and see whether or not there has been a history of a discipline in any manner in our office. because once the educator's been disciplined on the license, that's permanent. It's never expungible. It goes on a national list. Every other state in the nation has access to it if they try to get employment in another state. We publish that list annually, and I believe I brought it in for you last year when you were in committee. The problem is it shows up on our web as the list, and so that employers have to be very diligent and go through the list, and it's not connected to the license file. It just was something that I think procedurally has been overlooked, but we're working on that.
So if I understand you correctly, that is if disciplinary action has been taken, that would be flagged to you. But if there had been complaints and perhaps resolved in a prior situation that did not move to CSPC, that would not necessarily be information that would be passed along to a potential employer.
I'm sure that's correct. I believe, if I understand your question, that's correct. We don't pass on employment information, but we may use employment information for the discipline action.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was on that question. If you have taken disciplinary action in the past, when their certificate is given to them and it's used to get a new job, is that discipline on the certificate, or do we have to go back and search your list?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, it is not on their certificate. You would have to go search the list.
Follow. And you have to search each year's list, because it's not a cumulative list, is it, of all of them?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, today you would. In the very near future, what we have is electronic access to every single educator's file. And we know that employers are actively using that when they hire. So and we work very closely with HR folks, too, that if you had been disciplined and you were going to be hired, they could pull up your file and look and instantly discover whether the commission had ever taken any action against you.
Okay.
In the model that we're currently working on.
Oh, but not currently.
Not currently. They would have to look at the list.
Could
call us and ask, and we would research it. I mean, if they call our office and they ask, and they do, we tell them. I mean, we don't say, oh, no, you have to go look at the list. But, I mean, right now, if they were doing it independently, they would have to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you do that, though, if every school district on every hire was sending you the names to check? Could you get that done?
Well, Representative Roblin, Madam Chair, and I apologize for the word of that. The number of new hires every year is probably manageable because so many of them are new educators who don't have a record. It would just be people making transfers and doing other situations.
Representative Call.
Thank you, Chair.
My question is, what types of disciplinary actions are listed? Is a letter of reprimand part of that continuous file? Madam Chair, Representative Comp, the actions we take are as follows. The only thing that is generally in combination would be a probation. We can reprimand, suspend, or revoke, or we can suspend their right to apply or revoke their right to apply, which is no legal rule distinction, but I don't know why we do them. But in other words, they don't have a license and we won't let them apply for a certain amount of time. Any one of those could happen in combination with a probation that could last from 1 to 4 years. There could be only a probation. Now that I've said that, what would come up as a discipline would be anything that we've done a final order on, if it's a probation or a reprimand or a suspension or a revocation, anything that we've done a final order on.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? Thank you, Ms. Chamberlain. We invite Government Standards and Practices Commissioner Mr. Patrick Hoon forward. Just a gentle reminder that we will be sure to check the cell phones are off. Did you get yourself better?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Pat Hearn, Executive Director of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. I'm pleased to acknowledge being accompanied by Carl Vizentina, who is the chair of our commission. And I appreciate his taking the time to join me today. Government standards and practices law addresses two main areas of conduct. One is a prohibition against using office for a public position for personal financial gain. The second one is a requirement that public officials disclose financial conflicts of interest when those conflicts arise in the course of carrying out official duties. A public official is defined in statute as anyone who serves the state of Oregon or any political subdivision of the state in any capacity, compensated or not. So again, like teacher standards and practices, we do not investigate agencies or entities, we investigate individuals. The majority of our complaints come to us as the result of a signed complaint by any person. A small portion, perhaps 15 to 20% of our complaints, are the result of the commission initiating action on its own motion. We have not yet initiated any action in response to the newspaper coverage of the WESD. We have not received any signed complaints. I did receive a telephone call from a gentleman who expressed his outrage at what he read in the paper and inquired as to whether or not we would take any action. I told him we had not because we hadn't received a complaint, and I invited him to file a complaint. He did not do so. The commission meets again on January the 6th. This matter will be submitted to them as a result of the newspaper articles for their consideration in an executive session. Now, the law requires that cases that are initiated or complaints that are received new are confidential until the first phase of the process is completed. And that first phase is called preliminary review. And the preliminary review must be completed within 90 days of receipt of complaint or initiation of the action. And the case-related materials are not subject to public disclosure, and the commission staff and members are forbidden from making any public comment about the case, except for acknowledging that the case exists. The purpose of preliminary review is to determine if there's cause to go ahead and conduct a full investigation. So at the end of preliminary review, the case is either dismissed, that is, there's no finding of cause, or there is a finding of cause and a full investigation then ensues. At that point, and regardless of the outcome of the preliminary review, the case-related materials do become publicly disclosable. The preliminary review has to be completed, I believe it's within 90 days, and then the investigation must be completed within 120 days. The results of our investigations, or the sanctions that can be imposed, involve two forms. One is a forfeiture. That is, if a violation resulted in a public official obtaining personal financial gain or financial gain for themselves or a relative or a business that the official or relative is associated with, there can be a sanction of a forfeiture of up to twice the amount of that financial gain. In the other instance, that is where there's just a violation that's found for either failure to disclose conflict of interest or use of office for financial gain, there can be a civil penalty of up to $1,000 for each violation. And that doesn't mean $1,000 for each case, because quite often a case involves multiple violations. For example, a public employee who embezzles from their public agency 17 different times, that's 17 different violations, each one subject up to that maximum. I cannot say whether or not the commission will, in fact, initiate an action at their January 6th meeting. The information contained in the media reports indicates there may be possible violations of statute that the commission is responsible for enforcing.
Questions of Mr. Hinn? Representative Berger.
Thank you. If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Hinn, repeat again your statutory There's only two, failure to disclose conflict, and what was the other one?
Chair Flores, Representative Bender, it's prohibition against public officials using their position for financial gain. Those aren't the only two violations in the statute. Those are the primary ones. There's some financial disclosure issues and some others, but those are the two that are the most frequent.
Excuse me for clarification. So it's failure to disclose or use of office for financial gain are the two big ones. That's the two, one, two.
Sheriff Flores, Representative Burger, it's actually failure to disclose and or use of office. It can be both.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, I have several quick questions. Do you keep a record of these people so other states are checking to see if they've had guilty verdicts from your office from them? Second, were any of the Baker Union ESD employees punished by your office or penalized or whatever the term, legal term was for this? And Michael Bowles, was he, does your office automatically invest or take action or something like that and put a fine, penalty, violation, whatever, on those people?
Representative Flores, Representative Wisnett, I'm sorry, what was your first question?
Do you keep a list?
Yes, certainly. We have records. We have an automated database by date, by case number, by name. However, I don't believe that we've ever had a query from out of state on a case. In relation to Baker Union, my response is ostensibly the same as Representative or as Ms. Chamberlain's. That is, the law specifically precludes us from taking action while there's a criminal investigation pending. The criminal investigation is still pending, and I have occasional conversation with the lead Oregon State Police investigator, and he believes that the investigation will continue well into next year. And I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the name you mentioned, Representative Prisoner.
Michael Bowles is a DHS employee that has been sent for 8 years in prison for, sending friends to his friend who was running a foster home and abusing boys.
That was Michael Boyles with the Oregon Youth Authority.
Representative Flores, Representative Prisoner, is he the one that was sentenced for child sexual abuse?
He didn't do it, his friend did, but he was involved in it.
That matter has not come before us at all. I don't believe it would have any jurisdiction unless there was some financial gain that was obtained by him as a result of this, or if he was...
Madam Chair, there was a financial gain. He's going to be getting PERS for the rest of his life.
Representative Flores, Representative Wisman, PERS is part of official compensation, and that's a permitted form of financial gain. We could not take any action on that. Now, if his friend paid him for bringing him those children, we might be able to do something. But again, that has not been brought to our attention. Thank you.
Mr. Hayman, do you have a question? Now, when you began, you talked to us about if an action was initiated based on the decision of your board, which meets on January 6th, and then the preliminary review that would be confidential 90 days. Would that be the same process if there was a written complaint filed? Would that be a preliminary review period? It would be confidential in 90 days with which to come to a determination on how to proceed.
Chief Judge, yes.
Okay. And once again, you've indicated that you've received no written complaint from an individual regarding this Willamette ESD matter. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. I think it's safe to say that you probably will have one in the mail. Or two.
Sure, thank you. We look forward to receiving it.
Thank you. Sir?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just in the event that the mail doesn't come through or nobody submits it, excuse my cold. The chair is very interested in delving into this, at least to that initial stage.
We will have one hand delivered to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And
Attorney General's Office, Kevin Neely.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Neely. I'm the Executive Assistant to Attorney General Hardy Myers. We did receive your letter and questions, and I'll just walk through them relatively quickly. Before I get to the questions, I did want to just point out that the legislature has vested the Attorney General with investigative authority in a number of limited areas. The main areas are in consumer protection. We have civil investigative authority in that area. And then we have fairly broad authority for criminal investigations when it comes to public corruption cases and a number of other types of crime. So that's kind of the foundation upon which I'm going to answer your questions. And I would add that the Baker Union ESD is an example of one of those cases where we did undertake and are, in fact, as you know now, continuing to investigate a matter in a criminal case. In this case, we haven't received any information that there might be some sort of criminal wrongdoing. So with that, I'll get to the questions. The first question was whether or not we would conduct an investigation or assist the Oregon Department of Education with an investigation. That's a two-part question. In answer to the first part, the Oregon Department of Justice and the Attorney General are not at this point going to initiate an independent investigation, again, principally because there's no consumer protection issue here, and we haven't been alerted to any sort of criminal conduct that might, in fact, be at play here. If there is at some point an indication that there is some sort of criminal conduct, that matter may come to our office. In those instances, we more often than not work very closely with the local district attorney. In the Union Baker ESD, obviously, that's a big investigation, requires a lot of investigative resources, and there, the district attorney referred that matter to our office because we have more resources available. That might not be the case if, again, and this is total speculation, there were ever any criminal component here, and as I said, to this point, there hasn't been any indication. In Marion County, the DA has a lot of resources, and they will take that case himself. ODE, are we working with the Oregon Department of Education? The answer to that is yes. We're working very closely with the Oregon Department of Education on this matter. In fact, the attorney who's working on that is here with the department today. I don't want to steal their thunder, so I'm not going to go into how we're working with them in too detailed a manner. I'll let the Oregon Department of Education go over that, but I can assure you that we have been working closely with them for quite some time now on that matter. Moves on to the second question, which is what is the scope of DOJ's efforts? Again, I don't want to get into too detailed a discussion of this. I can tell you that we're working as a contact attorney through our general counsel unit with the Oregon Department of Education. And then if there are any other agencies that have an interest in this that would like to seek legal counsel, we stand ready to serve. I don't know if we've heard yet from either government standards or teacher standards, but again, those are two possibilities. There may be other possibilities out there. Right now, I think just the Oregon Department of Education has contacted us. Question three, will the information, when complete, be available to the public? The answer to that is yes, absolutely. Of course, with the caveat, anything that is either exempt from public records disclosure or expressly confidential is may or may not be released. A good example, any of the matters that are attorney-client privileged. In those instances, our office doesn't have any discretion as to their release. The client does. It would be the agency that we were working with that had that discretion. I think that it's safe to say that I'm confident that the Department of Education will be looking very closely at all the disclosure issues here and working with their attorney on that. Finally, the last question is if you're not conducting an investigation, why? The answer to that is we are working with the Department of Education on these matters. Again, it hasn't reached the level of a criminal investigation, as was the case in the Baker Union ESD. I don't know if it will ever reach that level, and if it does, I don't know if it'll be our office that handles it or the Marion County District Attorney's Office. I can assure you, if a request comes into the Attorney General, we will be as responsive as possible.
Yeah,
with that, any questions?
Yes, with the question of geography in mind, if I had a constituent in John Day that had concerns about their local school district or their ESD, which to me are very similar in nature, the first place to go when they are concerned about criminal activity would be the local DA. And you become involved as a second line defense. But if I were to recommend a course of action in John Bay or Mitchell or Fossil or Condon, it would be the district attorney.
Sheriff Flores, Representative Down, that's correct. On any criminal matters, the district attorney has the first right of refusal, as I like to say. In some of the smaller counties, our office steps in. We have a district attorney section, a district attorney assistant section in our shop that is expressly there to handle essentially overflow work or those cases that are so complex that there might not be prosecutorial expertise in the individual district attorney's office.
Further questions? Thank you. We have state's office. That would be plural.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chuck Hibner, deputy with the Audits Division. And with me is Ryan Dempster. Ryan is an audit manager, a CPA, and a certified fraud examiner, and has been helping to kind of help us sort through the information that we've been seeing regarding the USD matter. And likewise, we've been asked to respond to specifically four questions, but other questions, of course, are welcome. We have, so I hope it's not surprising that as the information has started to come forward, that the sort of questions you put in your letter and were asking us were similar to the sort of questions we were asking ourselves. You know, what are the issues? What are the audit issues specifically? And then what are we going to do to address them? As the constitutional auditor of public accounts, anything that involves state funds or federal funds or resources, we're interested in, and we have an obligation or a right or however you want to view it to make sure that those things are
so
important. Yeah, I understand. So to start addressing your questions, I guess the first question that we were asked similarly was, based on the public information and other information we received, will we be doing any investigation of WSD? I guess in preparation to answer that question, the short answer is yes, and we've been doing some investigating, researching. We've talked with a number of people who have an interest in this issue, specifically the vice chair of the ESD board. I spoke with him initially, and I spoke with him on a couple different occasions as to what he would be interested in knowing. Spoke with our Department of Education on a couple of occasions, trying to understand what the issues are. Spoke with the superintendent of the ESD, along with the deputy superintendent with WSD. Again, trying to kind of put just to understand what sort of questions are out there. As we started pulling the information together, it kind of leads to your second question of what would the scope of those be. We've put what we've heard so far kind of in a couple different buckets. You've got the federal funds issue. There's this migrant education grant that was awarded to the ESD through the Department of Education. And a lot of the things that we were of course initially heard of through the newspaper, but they confirmed when we talked to other folks about the equipment that was purchased with grant funds, potentially the reimbursement requests that may or may not be appropriate. Those sorts of things are falling under that category of federal funds. Now, we certainly have an interest in any of those federal fund grants, and we're going to make sure that we understand where those things went and how they were used by the time that we are done with that. That being said, working with the Department of Education, they also have an interest in making sure that those funds were granted and spent appropriately. And during our meetings with them, we were trying to determine what the best way to approach that sort of oversight responsibility would be. They've got it, we've got it, they want to investigate it. We've decided upon an approach where they will go in and do the initial investigation. We will take a look at what they have done, and then we will decide based upon what we see that they brought back whether there's additional work to be done on our part or not. And we will certainly do that as need be. There was a second issue regarding kind of a settlement and whether the ESD got good legal advice, and this came to us from the ESD board. They were really interested in knowing whether they got good advice or not from our attorney. That is not something that specifically we as auditors for the state would be concerned with. However, you know, the agreement, the ultimate agreement and the settlement amount, while it was paid, those sorts of things would be of interest to us. We think those kind of fall into that whole federal funds issue, though, as well. So we expect that there will be some of the investigations on that part of it through that mechanism. And then there was the kind of the third bucket of general, well, specific governance of the WESD and the management of that ESD, and then also as through other inquiries from other sources, specifically a letter we received from Senators Courtney Winters and Representative Berger was some questions about this general oversight of ESDs and calling for some audit work in that regard. We have yet to meet specifically with Representative Berger and the two senators mentioned. We will be doing that. We're hoping to do it this following week. We haven't quite gotten everything coordinated. We will do that to kind of, again, get a sense for what it is, what sort of questions are out there, and what sort of questions folks like yourselves, the decision makers, are interested in having answered from an audit's point of view. So we'll continue to work on that. In that same arena, there was a House bill that was passed this last legislative session, and I always forget, I didn't write the number, 3185, that invested some 3184? Okay. That specifically invested, thank you, Jim, that specifically invested some responsibility in the Department of Education around finding some efficiencies with some pilot ESDs, looking for some duplications and a review that is to be done. Through this process of just talking with the department about some of these other issues, they had asked, and we're certainly entertaining the thought of helping them with that review. So there's some specific oversight ties, some specific things that we may be able to do, but we'll see how that rolls out as things go on, how seriously they want to help and how much we are able to help. What was the next question? If that answers number two. Number three, will it be public? Yes, all the audit work we do, ultimately when it's done, there is a public report issued. If they're specifically protected, non-public information, confidential information, we will not divulge that as a part of our report, but our report will certainly mention that there's confidential information that was not divulged and what that might be. So that's kind of our process for that. And the fourth question, I believe we've kind of covered, since we will be doing some investigation, we're not exactly sure beyond the federal funds and our tie to that, how we might be going about it, but for the other issues, but we certainly will be. We'll be continuing to look at these issues, and we've expressed an interest in governance and kind of the performance of school districts and ESDs over the last couple of biennia, so I imagine we'll continue to have some interest in that. But
before we move to questions, for just a point of clarification, the House bill that had the pilot project for ESDs, I think, fortunately, WESD was one of those. That was a governance issue. The redundancies and the efficiencies,
correct,
was to be something that was explored across the board. So, just for clarification. Representative
Bell. I want to move through the process with you on an audit. Each school district and each ESD is required by law to have an outside agency provide an audit. And they have to refresh their auditor periodically, or at least go out for a bit. When that auditor gives a list of exceptions, you're usually an exit conference and minor issues are dealt with, and then a letter with major issues, and there's an obligation of the district to answer those issues. A copy of the audit also goes to the Department of Education. And if one doesn't answer those issues, you have to answer to the Department of Ed, I would suppose. You have to answer to the public. They have to be published. What happens with a Secretary of State's audit if they were to audit, say, a school district or an ESD? What is the process after the audit is taken? And then we'll make it a performance audit. Where does it go and what does it do?
Chair Flores, Representative Dallin, maybe I can take it back one step further, because we do have responsibility in that area as a Secretary of State under the Municipal Audits Act, which we administer. A big part of that act, of course, is allowing for the local
the local school district or ASD a contract with a local CPA firm who has a municipal audit license to do the financial audit that you're talking about. We administer that program. We receive copies of all those reports. Every year, our municipal audit manager will go through and select a percentage of those reports to review and look basically for standards issues and make sure the reporting is correct. And, of course, if there are any big findings in there or things that he needs to take note of, then he will. So we are in communication with both the local auditors in the area and also the local districts that may be asking for that information. Beyond that, I don't know if I answered your question completely.
Let's come into the process as you've just described. A local contractor provides the audit. You get a copy, and there's non-compliance. What does the Secretary of State's office do then? We've had our audit. The audit sheet has said to the district, do this. The district doesn't do that. What's your part in the play then? What do you do?
Within that program, Representative Dahl, Madam Chair, specifically, I'm not sure. I'm just not familiar with what our role is on egregious sort of exceptions that may be divulging an audit report. Our role in the process, from my understanding, is something I'm learning about here as we speak, making sure that the reports follow standards and making sure that things are reported properly and that the people who are doing the audits are credentialed and that they're reported properly. Oversight responsibility beyond that, I believe, is limited, but I can certainly get back to you with more details on that if that would be helpful.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions?
Point of information, Mr. Hibner and I have been trying to get together with with Senator Courtney and Senator Winters. Christmas has been the biggest issue getting everybody's schedules. So we will hopefully get to it next week.
Looking forward to that.
Posted at
progress. And we'd be happy to keep this committee posted in our progress as well, if that's something you would like.
We would like that.
Okay. I think it's only to imply that, to make sure you understand, there's been plenty of responsiveness. It's scheduling issues.
Understood. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I think we'll flip the last two presenters. Oregon School Board Association, John Marshall.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, distinguished guests, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Board Association. I was asked to visit with you this afternoon and share the training opportunities the School Boards Association affords school board members. And I have several school district ESD and community college board members, I should say. I've shared with you three documents that we prepare and distribute to our membership. The first is what we call a curriculum guide that lays out our training opportunities, conferences, workshops, convention, etc., in advance of a fiscal year so that local school boards can plan their calendars and decide which of those training opportunities they may wish to take advantage of. The second is a services brochure, and I would direct your attention to, I guess it would be the first inside page on the right. The pages aren't numbered, but under leadership training and what we do, and that lists the kinds of individual workshop opportunities that we would conduct for individual school districts, ESDs, community college boards, groups of individual school district ESD and community college boards at their request. And you can see they range from ethics and public meetings to governance, how to run effective meetings, parliamentary procedure, and so forth. And then lastly is a copy of the agenda of our annual summer board conference that was held this summer.
And since this is the year in which the election for a school district ESD and community college board members was held, much of the program, or at least half of the program, is directed towards new school board members and includes not only their governance role, but also sessions on public meetings, open records, and what their responsibilities are to require to comply with that law, as well as ethics and code of conduct. So the opportunities that we afford to school board members for additional training, I think, is broad and deep. Obviously, it's voluntary on the part of individual school board members as to whether or not they want to take advantage of those opportunities. And I would guess over the course of the year, with conferences, conventions, workshops, as well as individual work that we do with school districts, we are probably reaching close to 95% of the elected school board members in the state. So with that, Madam Chair, I hope that responds to the question that I had asked, and I'd be glad to respond to any others you might have.
Questions, Mr. Marshall, Representative
Donovan? Yes, Mr. Marshall. I'm concerned and want to dig out access and availability of this information. Last statistic, 95% of the board members will receive this training. With ESDs and public schools and community college boards, is there at least one member on each board that has had this training? Could you say that?
Representative Dowen, by using that statistic, what I mean is that over the course of a year, given all the opportunities that we afford school district, ESD, and community college board members, either in conferences or workshops we hold, regional meetings that we conduct throughout the state twice a year in 17 locations, or individual work that we do upon the request of a school district board, over the course of the year, we probably reach 95% of our members. Now, that does not mean that we reach 95% of our members with every single opportunity we have. It means that we're reaching that many in a variety of different ways.
Probably a question that I should address to somebody else. Where does a board member go? And I know that you have the information available, ethics, law, that sort of thing, confidentiality. Where do they go to get that information if they don't get it from you? Where are the providers of this information? And then the second part of the question, is it mandatory that they get some sort of in-service?
The first question, Representative Dowen, where do they go if they don't come to us? Certainly, I believe, and maybe this Mr. Hoon could better respond to this, but it would seem to me that if there were groups of elected officials out there that wanted more specific training on the code of ethics and conflict of interest statutes, that he or some of his staff would be more than happy to conduct something unique to that particular situation or for an individual board members or groups of board members. Is any training mandatory for the elected officials I represent? No.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Mr. Marshall, in the list of leadership training, is there anything in that list there that would cover the a board, the members of a board, especially of education service districts, receiving some kind of training or education in reviewing contracts, or is that part of the purview of members of a board?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I caught the contract about how to enter into contracts.
Do they have an oversight responsibility or review of contract responsibility of what contracts are as they are entered or if they're revised?
Madam Chair, to your question specifically, I don't know. But it would seem to me that, and I think these are just examples of the kinds of training opportunities we've offered, board member roles and responsibilities. Now, whether there's a piece of that particular program that talks about the role of the board in overseeing contracts entered into by the agency, whether or not they're expected to sign off on them or be aware of the entry into them, I don't know that.
maybe you could just give me a primer, then our Education Service District boards presented such things as contracts that have been negotiated for their review and approval in the normal course?
Madam Chair, it would seem to me that in the normal course of their business, they would certainly be aware of contracts entered into by the agency. And I might have to do a little bit more research, but it seems to me that there are statutes that require contracts above a certain dollar amount that the governing body is required to approve those, and if there's a dollar amount under which they don't have to. For example, a school district or an individual school enters into a service contract with a local copier company. Now, I'm not sure that's necessarily a contract that reaches the level of the school district board, but certainly a collective bargaining agreement contract is obviously one that would have to be signed off on the board, the superintendent's contract, and so forth. Other kinds of individual employment contracts, it seems to me, based on my recollection, that that those contracts are required to be approved by the board in some form.
So if they were approved by the board, they should be reviewed by the board, wouldn't you think?
It would seem to me, again, Madam Chair, that the actual approval of the contract and approval of the agency entering into the contract would be under the purview of the board. The performance and whether or not the individual employee is actually performing under the specified under the contract would seem to be more of a matter of the school district or the USD administration and not necessarily an oversight responsibility of the board, would be my guess. Maybe Representative Down, given his experience, might shed some light.
I'm asking John whether it's normal and customary for a board to review the provisions of a contract. When we look at the teacher's contract in general, the overall contract, specifically from that falls the individual contracts. When the board hires a superintendent, or they know the provisions of that contract. And is that generally accepted that they would know the provisions of the superintendent's contract?
One would hope.
If we have an individual outside of the negotiated agreement with the teachers, outside of the classified staff's negotiated agreement, let us meet a district office person. Could be a clerk, could be a curriculum director. Would the board be provisioned? Would they be conversant with the provisions? How much expectations in those contracts?
Would they be aware of a contract and perhaps compensation associated with the contract?
Yes.
Would they be familiar with all of the various and sundry provisions within that contract? I would guess most board members would not.
So it would be safe, from your experience, to assume that they know the dollar figure, they know the name of the person, but days of vacation, the minutiae, they would not. But they would know the salary and generally the job description.
Representative Dow, if you've ever read a contract, there's a lot of verbiage in there that's been written by lawyers for lawyers, and I would guess that a lay individual would look at that and say, I'm not sure I understand what this means, but our attorney, the school district's attorney, that negotiated said it's a good deal, and we ought to sign off on it. But as far as an intimate knowledge of all the provisions, I think it would be a stretch to assume that there was a well-founded knowledge that would exist.
Somebody in the district or the ESD has to know the provisions of that contract.
Mm-hmm.
If the board has a general overview, salary, basic conditions of employment, who knows the minutia?
Well, it's been my experience, and my limited knowledge in this area, and this is not my area of expertise at the association, but oftentimes school districts will rely on their attorney when it comes to
deciding whether to renew the contract of the superintendent, whether or when it comes to a decision that they want to dismiss the superintendent for whatever reason, they rely on the school district's own attorney to explain the provisions of the contract to them and what kind of liability they may be exposed to if they decide to make that to terminate the contract. So as far as the intricacies of the contract, I think the board relies on their attorney to give them advice about what they can do and what they can't do under those terms.
Thank you. That's what I was going to mean. And with the intricacies of terminating an employee contract or renegotiating an employee's contract and writing to ensure the legal technicalities, the reliance is on the superintendent or the superintendent and the attorney or the attorney in most cases with board members.
I believe so.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any additional questions for Mr. Marshall? Thank you very much. Oregon Department of Education, are you bringing the team? Or is it just you?
It's me.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and guests. For the record, Deputy Superintendent of the Oregon Department of Education, Vicki Fleming. I do have help in the audience should you have questions that I can't answer. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you about this. Our partners in the ESDs this afternoon, it's not the first time we've had this conversation, and it probably won't be the last. One unfortunate downside of representative government is the potential for failings and flaws, as we know all too well in Oregon. But I want to start by saying the risk, I believe, associated with empowering local citizens to engage in the decision-making process, the benefits considerably outweigh the concerns. The issue that we're talking about today, as you already know by listening to the previous testimony, is complicated. Neither the Oregon Department of Education nor any other agency has complete authority over an education service district or, for that matter, a local school district. My task, as you've assigned it today, is to speak specifically to what falls under the purview of the agency that I represent. So let me just begin by reiterating that we're working closely with the Secretary of State Audit Division, as you heard from Mr. Hibner, to determine if any state or federal funds have been misspent. We have the ability to intervene directly with regard to fiscal issues and have moved swiftly to review any of those expenditures and transactions related to that issue. Our ability to deal directly with personnel issues is much more limited. It's clearly an administrative function of the local ESD and its board. So I'm going to go through our legal responsibility in answer to your questions, and I assume you'll stop me at any point where I've given you an outline that really gives you kind of the high-level view of this. ESDs in Oregon statute under Chapter 334 are created as bodies corporate, which, as I understand it, is a legal term that really is a term for a corporation. They are legal entities that may sue and be sued. They are empowered to levy taxes, and they are governed by locally elected school boards. Our interest in this particular matter with Willamette Education Service District falls really into three categories. The first category would be the contractual relationship or the grants relationship, as you've heard earlier. We are responsible to oversee any funds, federal or state funds, that are granted by contract or a grant. And we as you've heard me testify before, we have many of those transactions and relationships with the 20 education service districts in Oregon. The terms of the contract or the grant define the responsibilities and the processes for oversight, monitoring, and compliance, and each one of those would characterize a different expectation in terms of federal assurances, et cetera, for monitoring and compliance. The authority is direct. It is authority granted to the Department of Education, overseen by the state superintendent, and ultimately by the state board of education, although most of the oversight responsibility for contracts and grants are obviously delegated to us as an operational matter of the Oregon Department of Education. So what have we done related to this particular incident from the department directly related to Willamette ESD? Last summer, in this particular case, the individual that's been reported on was responsible for managing some summer programs, some of which involved nutrition lunch programs, if you will. We did a review of those nutrition programs. We found that there were some expenditures that were being made inappropriately, and we disallowed the reimbursement of some funds and, in fact, did not end up giving the ESD what they'd ask us for in that particular program. We've done an internal audit beginning in about May of this year, 2005, of the migrant education monitoring and funding process to determine whether or not we were acting according to our due diligence for managing that contract fund, and that is also directly related to what you've read about in the media reports on this topic. We just this fall completed a visit from the U.S. Department of Education on their regular rotation of our management of migrant education funds on a statewide basis, and so we have the reports on that. We have done a review of the Willamette ESD reports regarding the migrant education oversight for this particular employee for the possible violation of contract or federal grant provisions, and we have met prior to today with Willamette ESD officials to review the specific allegations of improper expenditure of state and federal funds. Just FYI, the press report suggested that those funds had been misspent. Our tentative findings indicate that while the employee did not necessarily follow Willamette ESD internal financial processes, many of the expenditures were not on their face inappropriate. Willamette ESD will provide additional detailed records to verify all those expenditures at our request, and will continue to investigate other expenditures regarding the settlement agreement and the payment of the employee's legal fees, and basically where did the money come from and what did it pay for, and is that legal or not, is the question that we have yet to answer. The second area that the department would have responsibility for would be to oversee the standards that are outlined in statute and rule, and to manage appropriately the distribution of the state school fund as it relates to ESDs. State law authorizes the State Board of Education to adopt standards to determine the adequacy of services and facilities that are provided by ESDs. Standards for the ESDs are set out in OAR Chapter 581, Division 24. The state superintendent administers all state school fund allocations and oversees those statutes. So in that particular regard, we have some authority, albeit somewhat limited. What we've done in this area is, again, review the press allegations and Willamette ESD reports for possible violation of those Division 24 standards. At this point, our staff and our Department of Justice Legal Counsel have reviewed the press allegations and Willamette ESD reports for violation of Division 24 ESD standards and have found nothing at this point to indicate any direct violation. We have also, again, been in contact with the Secretary of State Audit Division and staff to discuss their investigation into the press allegations. And we have reviewed the Willamette ESD annual audit, and actually the audit that they will submit for this current year is not due until December 31st, and we will review that at that time when it is available to us. The third area of responsibility relates to local administration of ESDs and to, in fact, personnel decisions. And this really is an area where we have no authority. The locally elected ESD board is empowered to employ and fix compensation of personnel necessary to carry out the board's duties. They're covered by collective bargaining and employee relations board requirements. And as you heard earlier, the Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission has authority over the actions of individual teachers or administrators through licensure. So what have we done in this regard? We have contacted other state agencies with authority in other areas to ensure coordinated investigation and shared findings. And lastly, I just mentioned what you heard earlier, which is related to concerns regarding public records, what would be public, what would fall under attorney-client privilege, and the simple answer is public records are public and confidential records will be kept confidential. Specifically exempted employee records and student records obviously would be seen as confidential, and we would wish to err on the side of transparency and public disclosure of anything that we can legally do. So, all of that said, I'm concerned that we not overlook the controls and modifications that were implemented by the legislature just a few months ago. Both ESDs and local school districts have historically been controlled largely by a local constituency, even though state funding, state laws, and certain controls are vested in the Oregon Department of Education. And as you know, House Bill 3184 changed the rules for ESDs and will have a dramatic impact on the status quo. We have been working directly with those three ESDs under the pilot directive in House Bill 3184 about how those currently elected boards will be replaced with boards that are in fact elected by votes of the local school districts that are constituents in their particular regions, and that takes place by June 30th, 2006. So we have been working with the three of them on a regular basis and have crafted guidance and a process whereby new zones are identified and a process for the local districts to elect board members and recommend them. In addition, the legislature defined four core service areas which must be addressed by all ESDs. Those core service areas were developed prior to the session voluntarily by the education service districts. House Bill 3184 includes a requirement of a local service plan which covers all programs and services of all ESDs, including entrepreneurial activities. This service plan must be developed jointly with local school districts and must be approved by both the ESD board and the local school districts. Finally, I just want you to know anecdotally that the Department of Education, the 20 ESDs, and a cohort of local district superintendents are in the initial stages of developing a joint project funded by a Gates Foundation grant. We'll be working with the Annenberg Institute of School Reform from Brown University to explore the development of a three-tiered partnership that further expands and defines or aligns more clearly the work of the State Department of Education, the regional delivery system, and what local districts need in terms of supporting their school improvement efforts. So it's designed to bring the operations of all of Oregon's K-12 entities closer together. As you stated earlier, there is a fairly decentralized, complicated governance structure that currently exists, and this project is really about deciding what it is that we can do to bring more resources to bear more effectively on local schools and classrooms ultimately. This study was designed to provide a meaningful response to the legislature's mandate that we thoroughly explore redundancy in the educational system. And as the Secretary of State's representative indicated, one of the directives in House Bill 3184 asks the department to take a statewide look at redundant services and to come back to you with a set of recommendations about what can be done more efficiently or effectively. We have asked them to entertain the thought of assisting us, the Secretary of State Audit Division, with that, which would give us both the opportunity to learn a little bit more about the performance of the system, of the enterprise, which is something that I have heard you, members of the committee, ask for on a regular basis.
Madam Chair.
Representative Martin.
Thank you. The last bit that you were just talking about, is that still part of the Gates Foundation project?
Yes, the Gates, Chair Flores, Representative Avakian, we did receive a Gates grant just in the last few months, and a portion of that grant is dedicated to this work with the Annenberg Institute.
Sorry, may I have just a moment? Just want to make sure that I was understanding the last part of your testimony. And the study that you're referring to is a study that talks about the governance structure that you were describing.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason you're doing that is because the legislature asked you to. Is that a fair statement?
Chair Flores, Representative Avakian, two issues. The bill directs the department to work with these three pilot ESDs, Willamette ESD, Northwest Regional ESD, and High Desert, on redesigning their governance and election of their boards. The Gates-funded project with Annenberg is about aligning state, regional, and district-level support for school improvement. What is it that we can do to better support the
communities? I guess what my question is that I'm curious about is that's a great endeavor, but why in the world does that need to be funded by private sources rather than by government sources? It certainly seems to me that a government reviewing how it is going to govern is something that would be paid for by taxpayer dollars rather than some private grant. Maybe you could explain that.
Madam Chair, Representative Ibaki, the Gates grant is really about a top-to-bottom review, both at a policy level and somewhat at an operational level. So included in that proposal are some of the policy issues that you discussed with the State Board, a review of our standards in Oregon, a review of our high school graduation requirements, a look at the system alignment, a look at how we do integrated budgeting, that's really pre-kindergarten through higher ed, and this regional, state, regional, local partnership. So it's part of a bigger package of a comprehensive view of the whole system.
My question is, why private money instead of public money?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, we've experienced a fairly constrained budget at the state agency over the course of the last three biennium, and I'd be happy to share those numbers with you anytime we have the opportunity, and we're asked by Gates to submit this proposal to get extra resources to do our work. We're happy to take advantage of that opportunity.
Thank you.
Public-private partnership, Representative Avakian.
One way to describe it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Rothman, for your question, because I'm glad that the Annenberg Institute is being utilized, because I served on the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, and I see Ms. McGlashan is in the back of the room, and I sent a note to the chair of that committee asking for the Annenberg Institute to come in and review the Department of Education, because Portland Public Schools hired them to do a review of their central office and the whole operation, and they found they were wasting a heck of a lot of money, and they found ways to be more efficient about it. And so I had asked Chair Devlin if it would be possible to bring the Annenberg Institute in and review the Department of Education. So that never happened until this grant came forward, and so I'm glad that we're doing it, because I actually think there are a lot of inefficiencies in the department and how education services are delivered, not just from the state level, but all around, how they all mix and match. And I think that was one of the reasons that I was pretty strong. I was pretty clear about holding on to this governance structure in House Bill 3184, even when the House was getting very quirky and nervous about it. And because, you know, ESDs are sacrosanct, but I think clearly that the Willamette ESD situation is showing us that there are questions that need to be asked about how the money is spent from the top down to the bottom up. And hopefully this Annenberg Institute study will be good. They are a very reputable institute, so I have a lot of faith that study will be beneficial and will help us save money in the long run. And whether it's paid for by taxpayer dollars or private dollars, I don't really care at this point. I just want it done. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dahl.
I'd like to return to the budget area. And we talked about two budget areas, one state dollars that are allocated to schools, and then we talked about migrant aid. With state dollars that are distributed by your office, when the line items are developed, does the state say to any of the districts, you must put this much in this line item and this much in this line item, or do you tell them how much they've earned and send it to them?
Chair Forrest, Representative Dahlem, we have a very clear funding formula that allocates money on the basis of attendance. We do not...
So if I proceed this further, the department's job is to determine how many students were in that school and how much money they have, and then the money is sent to the school, and it is incumbent, or the ESD, and it is incumbent upon them to determine the line item it goes in. That's pretty much great. Now let's look at migrant ed and get a little closer vision, if you might. Migrant ed isn't quite like that, is it? I mean, in that when the migrant ed money comes from the federal government, there is somewhat, there's a cap on, I believe, administration, there's a cap on transportation, there's a cap on lunch. Would that be a true statement? Migrant ed is done a little bit differently.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahl, each of our federal funding streams comes with a little bit different mix of criteria for how we get it and how we manage it, but yes, you are correct.
So let's take a look at one of the federal funds, and in this particular case, we'll look at migrant ed. Let's say the school district had set up their budget, or an ESD, and we know the ESD to be more specific, and 93% of their budget was set up in administration and 7% in textbooks, and the rest was other. Would you look at that? Would you say this migrant ed budget might be a bit askew?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahl, we would only look at that to the extent of knowing whether or not the expenditures met the expectation outlined in the law. In terms of if there is an exception and something has been misspent, we would want to take it.
So you come in not on the budget building side, but on the back side after the money has been spent, and you align expenditures with what the mandates of the migrant ed program were, and if they're out of bounds, then what happens to the school district if they spent 93% of their budget on administration and 7% on textbooks? What happens then?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I think that would be up to the management principles and internal controls of the local school district. Where we might get involved and have, in fact, since the implementation of No Child Left Behind, relates to the conversation we were having this morning, is the money that is dedicated to a certain set of expectations and a performance of a certain cohort of children actually accomplishing that or not? And if not, why not? And so, in fact, if the performance expectation is not being met, the question would be, is the money actually going for what we would expect it to go for? In terms of monitoring and compliance, that might be a question that we would ask at some point.
So, at what point in time does the State Department have to justify the expenditure of money to the federal government? This is not going to wait forever, I don't think, is it? If we have a budget that is so seemingly out of balance in a federal fund, this isn't going to last forever, is it?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahl, we, on a rotation, have visits from the U.S. Department of Education that look at the various funding sources that we have, and we, in turn, on a rotation, visit local school districts to examine that. And we have annual financial audits that would hopefully identify exceptions related to the law and the expenditure of the funds. I'm not sure I'm understanding. Are you saying if too much money is being spent on administration?
Too much money in any one line item is good. And let me give you a little clue to where I'm going. In the migrant ed programs that I'm familiar with, if we were to put 93% of the money to be paid directly to the superintendent at the chin of the school district, the ESD would say, you're not going to do that. The ESD would say, we have an obligation to get these kids here. And then when the transportation budget was provided, it would be reviewed to be sure that it was adequate and not within a tolerance. So what I'm asking is, and I'm trying to lay the responsibility for building the migrant ed budget, where is the oversight, and does that come when the ESD budget is audited by the auditor they hire, or is it done by you?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahl, a little bit of both.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions for Ms. Fleming? I would just make a comment and a concern, I think, that in part of this at least coverage that we're seeing, and some comments that were recently made by a member of the Willamette ESD board regarding that saying we should put this back on the legislature. They should pay for any investigation of the WESD. They're providing no resources for the defense of the agency. One, I think that's going to be something we're going to have to take a collective look at. And then by the same token, the same board member a year and a half ago indicated when the WESD was forming a committee to review policies and considering the requirement, the premise for some of my questions with John Marshall, that all members review contracts before they're signed and saying, how many of us on this board really don't know what we're doing with regard to spending public money? Mm-hmm. That's cause for concern. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of prompting that line of questioning, but I think it might be something that we're going to have to deal with as this thing expands rather than contracts. Thank you very much. Comments, questions? As in the memo that we, or letter that we sent out to the various entities, I indicated how important I thought it was that we hear from these bodies because, so that taxpayers would have the assurance that any real or perceived misuse or mismanagement of funds would be addressed. And I think that the superintendent underscored that last week when she said the legislature should aggressively pursue any of those perceived issues. And so I wanted the agencies that would have this potential oversight responsibility to come and let us know what their areas of responsibility would be. Representative Berger?
Chair, if I could comment, deep appreciation to you and members of this committee for allowing me to sit down on this, because there's an awful lot of issues that play in here. I served on a school board. I know how tough it is as volunteers to oversee a huge bureaucracy, if you will, that has a mission that is critical to every single customer, if you will, be parents, children, taxpayers, and try and reach into that and understand all the goings on as a layperson who is not trained. It's similar to what we face in the legislature. It's just hard to know where to best put your resources and energy to try and be an effective leader and at the same time not eat up everything you've got, and we struggle with that always. As you well know, I had issues around governance and ESDs long before this particular issue, and I think in our own mind we kind of have to separate what happened in this ESD from the issue of ESDs totally, because this I think could have happened in any school district the way they are currently devised. I don't think, in my own mind, that this is necessarily strictly an ESD issue. One of the things that I've pondered, and I appreciate that this committee has pondered the same thing, okay, something happened, our constituents, and we are unhappy with it. How do we prevent it from happening again? How do we get at sort of systemic issues that will keep this from being further? It's very much, I think Representative Wisnett is right, it's like the Patel thing that we dealt with yesterday. How do we prevent that kind of thing from happening again? As long as you have citizen oversight, I think that there's always going to be this tension and this problem. I will be meeting for your information with the Secretary of State's office. I think this board has, in their own way, welcomed, okay, if you don't like what we did, tell us how to, you know, what you want or what the remedy is. Or I have not sensed ever from this board anything but a willingness to say, okay, you know, come and look, come and talk to us. And in that spirit, I hope that we can get at some of these ESD governance issues and at the same time sort of resolve in our own mind that we've looked into these issues in a productive way. And I really appreciate today's hearing. It really helped me get focused.
Thank you. Any further comments? Well, I thank all the agencies for coming forward and being responsive, and it does appear that at least we're all moving in the right direction in the areas that you can. I hope that you will keep us apprised as a committee of progress that you make as you can. And I think that it would be appropriate for this committee to have probably a follow-up in 6 months and see what progress there might be made at that time in this specific regard. So thank you very much. Committee, we will advise you of our next meeting date, which will probably be in close to mid-February. And once again, be ready for a full day. And thank you very much. Travel safely, travel well, and Merry Christmas.